Good Thursday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM, Patriot 125 and more. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, coming to you from beautiful Farmville, Virginia today, where it is once again hot as blazes. We've got a great show for you coming up on the program this hour. Chuck Michelle of Michelle and Associates talking about Californians losing their gun rights with barely a whimper. Also, Taylor McCarty, conservative media strategist, has a piece of the Washington Examiner on the women's march. He calls it a hypocritical shot at the NRA. Sean Maloney from Buckeye Firearms Association, member of the NRA's board of directors, joining us next hour. Once again, the anti-gunners in Ohio targeting the wrong people. That the headline from a Cleveland Plain Dealer editorial this week, at least from a member of the Cleveland Plain Dealers editorial board. Now, I also want to talk with Sean about a story I saw. One of the local Fox affiliates in Ohio actually went out and accompanied several dozen educators as they went through that faster firearms training in Ohio recently. So we've got some more school districts that are adopting the faster program and are ensuring that there will be an armed response if, God forbid, there is an attack on the schools. Lars Daleside, NRA ILA media liaison, joins us in hour three for a legislative report card. Every town for gun safety is out proclaiming it's been a great year for gun control. I'm not so sure about that, but we'll talk about it with Lars coming up in hour three. Steven Cruiser of IJ Review, he'll be with us in hour three as well, talking about some of the big stories of the day. And I believe, Cameron, do we have Mr. Garrity with us? Is he ready to go? Not yet. All right. Jim Garrity from National Review will be joining us here momentarily, talking about some of the big stories of the day, including the continued fight and debate over health care. I believe we've got Mr. Garrity joining us via the telephone this afternoon. How are you, Jim?
Hey, Cam. Sorry, I can't join you by Skype today.
That's okay. And I was wearing a special T-shirt for you too. The folks at home will be able to see this, but you will not. You'll have to go back and watch the playback. It's my goat wearing a Tom Brady jersey that I know you as a Jets fan would appreciate. So I try to wear that, especially as we head into football season. But I'm sorry you can't see it.
I appreciate that, Cam. I've been thinking about this though. What do you call one goat? Who stands out head and above, head and shoulders above all other goats throughout, going back to the beginning of time?
Is he
the goat? Do you just write his name goat in all capital letters? Is it a G goat, a G goat? So there's your next T-shirt, Cam. And I bet you will raise the greatest goat of all time.
I can only hope one day. Right now we've got five girls who are not being milked right now, and they're very. Very angsty about that. But there's a lot of stuff going on, I tell you what, that's more important than my goats. And let's talk about this, because right now, so President Trump is over in France right now, and I saw that the media snark of the day is reacting to President Trump's comment that a lot of people don't know that France is our oldest ally. And this, for whatever reason, is the line that many in the media have picked up on and said, oh, really, people don't know that? Jim, I'm pretty sure, according to, you know, a lot of geographic polls, there are a lot of Americans who couldn't point to France on a map, much less, you know, could talk about the alliance with France during the War of Independence. Now, I know this, but I think it's a fair statement that probably a lot of Americans are not aware of that.
You know, Cam, you and I have talked about the things that are considered common knowledge in one part of the country or with one community and aren't common knowledge elsewhere. I remember a couple of years ago talking with my friends and making a reference to Idi Amin, the infamous Ugandan dictator, and no one had any idea who I was talking about. They'd never heard of him. And this is before that film starring Forrest Whitaker had come out. And I kind of made fun of them. But then after a while, when it was clear that nobody else at the table had ever heard of this guy, I was the freak. And I was the weirdo who hadn't heard of that. So something like, you know, yes, you know, France fighting on our side. In the Revolutionary War, the fact that Lafayette Square is right across from the White House, the Statue of Liberty. Yeah, you know, probably most people who studied American history or remember studying it in school probably recall that, but probably a lot of folks won't. I can't. What's kind of fascinating about this is, you know, I might chuckle about Trump saying something like that, but really, in the grand scheme of, you know, his presidency, how much time and energy do they want to spend on, you know, an offhand comment like this? which is undoubtedly meant to, outreach. But it's fairly clear that, you know, Emmanuel Macron and Donald Trump did not really hit it off in their first meeting. Macron should be there in office for another couple of years. Trump's going to be in office for at least 2020, if not beyond that. And you kind of figure, okay, these guys have to build a working relationship. And Trump, when he was invited to the Bastille Day festivities, and decided to go over there for about a 24-hour period. I understand they're going to have dinner at the top of the Eiffel Tower. And, you know, as much as I've had disagreements with Trump, I think he is genuinely trying to throw himself into the personal diplomacy, the personal diplomacy aspect of the presidency. And, I think he deserves some credit for that.
I do, too. And I suppose we should just be grateful, Jim, that this has delayed the inevitable guillotine jokes that will be coming from... I'm not sure. We should probably start a poll, maybe a pool. Is it going to be Chelsea Handler? Surely Kathy Griffin's going to keep her mouth shut about any sort of guillotine jokes. But, you know, at some point during Trump's visit to France, someone on the left is going to think, this is going to be funny. So I suppose we should be grateful that right now they're just snarking about the president's comments about France being our long-term
ally. I'm not surprised that so many folks on the left are coming back and eagerly anticipating or making allusions to the French Revolution. I'm equally unsurprised that so many folks on the right make their allusions to the American Revolution. They were not the same. They did not turn out the same. They did not have the same goals. Or maybe they may have had some similar impulses in the beginning, but they went in extremely different directions. So anybody who's thinking too fondly of the French Revolution, I think, reveals a bit about themselves, perhaps unintentionally.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's not forget that one of the rising publications on the left these days is the magazine Jacobin, named after the Jacobin faction of those who, you know, helped to bring about the terror during the French Revolution. Just a little point to ponder there. Meanwhile, back here in the United States, Jim, it's back to healthcare, right? Mm-hmm. And can the Senate Republicans put together a bill that will get the support of the Senate Republicans? I mean, that seems to be an open question at this point.
It is, and I was writing something in the Morning Jolt newsletter earlier today. I try not to be too cynical. I try not to let readers believe that the news is boring or that it's not worth following. But, Cam, I think, you know, we can speak bluntly and say there are days where it does feel like the news is Groundhog Day. At some point during today, there will be a rumor that the Republicans have the votes. And then there will be a rumor afterwards that, no, they don't have the votes. And then, you know, Mitch McConnell and guy, you know, and the people who are, at least last I checked, were wary about this or not ready to sign on are exactly the ones we've seen before. Susan Collins, the Republican of Maine, who's you can classify as a moderate or a squish, depending on your point of view. Rand Paul, who has more of a libertarian perspective, says, look, this is good, this is better, but it's not the full repeal I'm looking for. I can't sign on to this. And Rob Portman of Ohio, who actually is probably, you know, kind of smack in the middle of the caucus, just kind of looks at this and still is not ready to sign on. Because, you know, here's the thing. When Republicans are operating with only 52 seats, I know we're saying only 52 seats, but, you know, is a slim majority, you can't lose three. You can only lose two. And there's at least the three I mentioned, Dean Heller out in Nevada, still very nervous about this. And if it passes 50-50, just like the very slim margins by which Obamacare passed in 2009, 2010, anybody who votes yes can say they were the deciding vote. And you can kind of picture the attack ads, you know, here's mm-hmm. little Timmy who's losing his health insurance. And, you know, Senator so-and-so is the one who voted to take it away. So, you know, Republicans know there's a political risk to this. Now, I looked at the version that came out now. I took out the tax cut for the highest income folks, who I thought was as much as I might think that's a good policy, I think that is something that's going to complicate the effort to pass the bill. It is the easiest talking point for the Democrats, so I think that's worth addressing in the tax reform bill when it ever gets brought to the floor of the House and into the Senate. I thought most of the improvements looked pretty good to me. Now, they're not sweeping changes, but at this point, you don't want to make sweeping changes. But for these kind of reluctant Republican senators, they're apparently not there yet. I think at some point, you can kind of understand the exasperation of Mitch McConnell or any of these other kind of Republicans and a leader saying to the Republicans I've mentioned before and Lisa Murkowski up in Alaska saying, okay, what will you sign on to if this isn't it? Because we've tried to make these various little concessions to, you know, keep all these little factions happy and put in each provision necessary to get those 50 votes.
You know, and as you're describing this, I mean, I know that this is how this is how legislation gets made. But to me, Jim, this is like a clear warning sign as to why you should not want the government involved in every aspect of your life. Because, you know, what was supposed to be a remedy to, you know, allow more Americans to purchase insurance has sort of failed to meet the expectations of its authors, right? The enrollment markers have never been what the proponents of Obamacare thought they would be. Is that fair to say?
If nothing else, we can say the individual market in a whole bunch of states has, if not collapsed, is on the verge of collapse. We've all heard about the figures of the sheer number of counties in which there are no insurers on the individual market anymore. The effort to make it easy for you to be able to buy insurance separate from your employer if your employer does not offer it has failed. I think it's safe to say this is not where Obama thought it was going to be. It's not where Pelosi or Harry Reid or any Democrat who voted for this thought there would be more and better options for people. And for the vast majority of people who are told that nothing was going to change that they didn't like, that if they like their plan, they could keep their plan. If they like their doctor, they could keep their doctor, that they'd be paying, you know, $2,500 per year less on in premiums. They haven't gotten that at all. And those were really important selling points. I'm glad, you know, we can argue about the expansion of Medicaid. I'm among those folks on the right who thinks it was not necessarily such a terrible idea, although the problem with any expansion of entitlements is once you expand it, it's almost impossible to undo. And the costs then tend to skyrocket. They tend to blow up a lot bigger than even the most conservative estimate.
So. Well, yeah, and listen, I'm not pretending to be an expert on the healthcare debate by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think about the unintended consequences, right? And it sounds, and again, that's where we've seen most of the benefit in terms of Americans being able to be insured. It hasn't come from the Obamacare plans. It's come from Medicaid expansion. But as you say, you know, first of all, there's a difference between having coverage and receiving care, right? And that's become increasingly problematic with the Medicaid expansion, trying to find doctors who will accept new patients, dentists who will accept new patients. It's very, very difficult for a lot of Medicaid patients to get that. So they may have the coverage, but they're not necessarily getting the care. But again, from a political standpoint, right now, if you try to fix this, now you're taking something away from people, right? Even if you can make the argument of, look, this is not the most cost-efficient way for these folks to get care, there's a better way to do it. As you say, the attack ads write themselves. You are on Medicaid now, and they are going to take it away, or they took it away.
Absolutely. And this is, you know, one of the, you know, great, probably the thorniest issue for Republicans. And the deep down, they know it's not a good, you know, Medicaid is not the ideal system. And you talk to governors like Scott Walker, they say, look, we really want to get people off of our state Medicaid system, not because we're mean, not because we're nasty, not because we like seeing poor people suffer. We just want, you know, if you attach it to our, you know, welfare to work, you know, programs, we can get people jobs and their employers offer insurance. They can get insurance through their employer and they'll actually be happier with that. Most people who report being very satisfied with their plans are happy with ones that they get through their employer. This is very much kind of tied into, can you get people, you know, jobs that are not merely, no offense to those who flip burgers, but, you know, minimum wage jobs, jobs that do not offer health insurance, into jobs that do. Once you do that, the options are better. There's, you know, the employer covering part of the cost and things like, you know, so the people generally have a higher level of satisfaction. There's this study that was done out in Oregon that I think is kind of, no, it's not the Rosetta Stone, really worth mentioning in this context. So they looked at 10,000 people who qualified for Medicaid and 10,000 people who did not. They didn't have enough funds to cover all of them, so they just covered the first 10,000 people. And they were able to find out that the good news is the people who were on Medicaid felt less stress. They were less worried about how they were going to pay for their medical bills because obviously they were on Medicaid. They felt more psychological comfort. But when they actually looked at the actual health results, their health had not improved compared to the people who were not on that. So we can kind of ask a fair question of, hey, wait a second, does Medicaid do what we really want it to do, which is get people healthier and keep people in better health? Or is it just a very expensive program? And the great irony is, Reese talked about doctors who won't take Medicaid patients. They're not doing this because they're mean. They're not doing this because they're cold-hearted or they hate poor people or anything like that. They say that the reimbursement rates are lower than whatever it costs for the actual treatment, that they take a loss on every Medicaid patient that they treat. So some doctors will say, look, I'll treat as many as I can, but at some point I'm not made of money. and I can't afford to lose, you know, I cannot afford to treat more patients than this. Also, I remember hearing a while back from a couple of doctors, I kind of asked my readers their experiences, and for better or for worse, Medicaid patients apparently are much more likely to not show up for a scheduled appointment. We can argue about all the different reasons that is, but you can imagine if you are if you're a doctor and you've got a practice you're trying to run, you have expectations that you're going to have, you know, three patients at 9, 9:15, and 9:30, and they don't show up, you know, the productivity of your day is kind of thrown by stuff like that. So, yeah, pretty complicated system, and but I think I can understand the irritation of the grassroots, the sneaking sense of, hey, wait a second, we thought we were getting somewhere with this. We thought we got a Republican president, a Republican senator, a Republican House of Representatives. Now we can finally repeal Obamacare and replace it with something better. Mm-hmm. And so far, it's very slow going.
All right, so last question for you. How does this impact things like, let's say, the National Right to Carry Reciprocity Act or maybe the Hearing Protection Act? You know, some I've seen some tweets from lawmakers saying, look, this is the most productive House in history. We look at how many bills that we've passed. As a gun owner, I'm kind of waiting here, and I know that they've got, you know, Trump Care to deal with, and they've got tax reform to deal with, but I'm kind of twiddling my thumbs here, Jim, wondering, okay, when does the Second Amendment stuff get in the queue?
That is a very fair question, Cam, because earlier today I wrote about the new VA Secretary David Shulkin, and probably the most significant piece of legislation that has been signed into law by President Trump was what is, you know, given the shorthand of the VA Accountability Bill. It expanded the authority of the Secretary to fire people, expedited processes for investigating wrongdoing, protections for whistleblowers, all that kind of stuff. And I think it's a really good, important bill. And I talked to a bunch of veterans groups, and they're all happy with it. I think it's safe to say Republicans would like to go into the midterms with more than just that. That's a fairly big deal. Now, it's conceivable that sometime in the next year they'll have a confirmation fight if Anthony Kennedy retires. That could take up a good chunk of the Senate's time in 2018, if that comes to pass. The reciprocity bill, look, if you're the Republicans, you kind of want to start putting points on the scoreboard, so to speak. And it's great that the House has passed all of these bills. And at some point, the Senate really ought to look at those, you know, that long list of stuff stacking up on their desk and saying, okay, what can we pass quickly? What is going to have the least objections? What is the simplest and easiest path to get more than, you know, 50 votes or more? And let's get this stuff through there, because I think there is this, as much as by and large Republicans are still supporting the president, they're still you know, they're not feeling too dispirited or anything like that. They want to see results. And there is this kind of irritating sense that it's been, you know, it's been slower than Beltway traffic, to use a metaphor that, you know, hopefully everybody across the country will understand. That's a metaphor for bad, everybody. You know, bad, moving slowly, clogged, and great irritation to describe the pace of legislation getting to the president's desk.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess with all the global warming, we can't use glacial anymore because nobody will get that reference, Jim. Much like an EDMM reference.
Yeah.
By the way, did you take your friends out to Mexican food after that, after you made the EDMM joke? And
exactly. You know, David Brooks' extraordinarily fancy sandwich restaurant, it's full of Italian meats that you can't even pronounce can.
Right. You know? Kappa, what? Yeah, I know. Jim, listen, we got to run, but I appreciate you joining us on the program, sir. It is great talking with you today.
Always enjoyed it, Cam. Can't wait to see you again.
Me too. Next time we'll talk about Kid Rock for Senate, okay?
I'm looking forward to that. Can't wait.
All right. Jim Garrity joining us. He's a cowboy, baby. Chuck Michelle of Michelle & Associates. He's going to join us on the program right after a quick timeout, talking about what is going on in the once great state of California. Could be great again. Stick around. Much more Cam & Company coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Emily Mead with NRA Hunters for the Hungry. Emily, welcome. Tell me, what is NRA Hunters for the Hungry?
Well, NRA Hunters for the Hungry is a program that originally started back in 1993, and it is a way for hunters to either donate their protein or their time for a great cause.
That's a great idea. Why did NRA get involved with this? Why did they think it was important to do this?
NRA got involved because they were looking for an option for hunters to give back to their community, and something to help everyone at large. So this program allows you to do that. By donating the protein from your animals, it goes to either food shelter or it goes to shelters or food banks or churches or people in need in general.
That's great. So tell us a little bit, how does it work? How does a hunter walk us through either donate his their protein or their time?
Currently, we have a fabulous website. And by going there, there's a Get Involved tab. And once you go there, we have a geotagged map on the website, which will put you in contact with a processor near you, as well as a taxidermist, if that's something you're interested in. As for donating your time, we also allow you to contact us, and we can put you in contact with the affiliate program that is closest to you.
Awesome. Speaking with Emily Mead with NRA Hunters for the Hungry. And, Emily, how do we get more information about the program?
To get more information about the program, you can either go to our website, which is huntersforthehungry.nra.org, or you can email us at hservices@nrahq.org, or you can even call at 1-800-492-4868.
Emily Mead, NRA Hunters for the Hungry, thank you for what you do. Thanks for what the NRA does. This is great stuff, and thanks for being on the program.
To the ungrateful who unjustly condemn America's police force, your shallow criticism doesn't define the brave who wear the badge. Their courage speaks for itself. In an era where many profit from passing the buck, our police are the first to step up. When their fellow Americans come under threat, they don't stop to take a public opinion poll. A rare breed who embrace long hours and a thankless job. It's in their blood to defend men, women, and children of every race and background. They even protect the ungrateful, the ones who are quick to criticize, but even quicker to dial 911 when they are afraid. Here's a message to the media, the self-serving politicians, and the Hollywood hypocrites who condemn America's police. What makes you think anyone wants to hear your elitist, uninformed opinions? These are our brothers and sisters, sons and daughters. They are our parents and neighbors, scoutmasters, church leaders, PTA presidents and volunteers. They serve our communities and country with dignity and honor. Every day, they leave for work and kiss their families goodbye, knowing it could be the last time they do so. The NRA has the backs of those willing to take on violent criminals to protect our values and way of life. We commend the courage of those who wear the badge, especially in this time when their bravery has come under scrutiny. Ungrateful critics may seem loud. Your courage under fire is deafening.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Just watching that video during the break. Reminded me of our Good Guy of the Day segment coming up top of hour three. It's a good one, Cameron. You're going to love it. Involves a dog and a happy ending. I know that's already sold you. Cameron Gray sent me a story as well. An actual good article from the New York Times. I was really surprised to see that. But credit where credit is due. A profile of a police officer in Laconia, New Hampshire, who is actually making a dent in the opioid epidemic up there. We'll talk about that a little bit later on in the program. Right now, I want to welcome from Michelle and Associates out in California, our friend Mr. Chuck Michelle. Chuck, good morning to you, sir.
Cam, how are you?
I am good. I appreciate you coming on the program. How's California right now?
Well, we've got a bit of good news. We've got the judge in San Diego put an injunction in place that stops the enforcement of the law that would have made everyone who possessed a magazine that could hold over 10 rounds a criminal. So that's pretty good. That's a big win. And I've written a couple articles about that people are responding to, and the word's getting out pretty good. And I think everybody appreciates what the NRA and CRPA did together there.
Well, this was a big decision because this law was getting ready to go into effect on July the 1st. People who were in possession of these magazines legally were going to be criminalized overnight. They were not going to be allowed to possess these magazines. The judge recognized this. Now, again, this case hasn't even gone to trial yet, but that temporary injunction stops the law from being enforced for the time being. Is the state of California, Chuck, are they going to challenge that up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals?
They haven't committed 100% yet. We have heard from them. They say they're still deciding. I suspect that they will appeal, and then we'll be in a fight on whether or not the trial court, the lower court that issued this ruling, whether this judge should stay that case while they try and go up or litigate both tracks at the same time. We're in favor of litigating both. That appeal could take a year. So we want to get the permanent injunction in place and then appeal from that if they want to.
Okay. And the judge in this in issuing this temporary injunction, I mean, he didn't decide the case, but he said based on the evidence that he's seen and the argument presented by the state of California, he doesn't think they're likely to win at trial on the merits. And he pointed out a couple of constitutional concerns about this magazine ban. One, whether or not Californians have the right to decide for themselves how best to protect themselves against an attack. And two, Chuck, and I want to make sure that I get the language right, so I might ask you to talk about this. But he also talked about Californians who may one day be called upon to serve in a militia capacity and who would need to have the accoutrements with them for that situation. Is that right?
Yeah. And it's an interesting point because, first of all, put it in context of where he came from. He and his family escaped from communist Cuba back in the 60s. So he's had firsthand experience with communist regimes, tyrannical, you know, dictatorships, and what it's like to live under one. So he appreciates the founding fathers, you know, anticipating and doing things to prevent that kind of thing from happening in this country. And that includes a well-regulated militia. But after Heller and McDonald came down, everyone focused on the fundamental right to self-defense and the need for firearms for self-defense. And that was the core discussion in those cases. Those weren't militia cases, except to the extent that they needed to rule out that militia was not the exclusive reason to have the right to keep and bear arms. But it is still one of the reasons, along with self-defense and defense of others, defense of property, whatever, and guarding against a tyrannical government.
Talking again with Chuck Michelle about this temporary injunction. Meanwhile, the Spectator website, spectator.org, has a column, Stephen Greenhut, losing their gun rights with barely a whimper, talking about California. He says, from what I've seen, the public often will support aggressive new restrictions. Gun owners will meekly hand over their weapons to agents. Gun rights groups will quietly protest but have little sway. Republican lawmakers will make things worse as they try to prove their commitment to taking guns out of the hands of quote-unquote criminals. The erosion of our fundamental rights will take place so slowly that few will protest too much. Now, Chuck, I'll be honest with you. I don't think anybody's going to call California a success story for the pro Second Amendment aside, but I will object to that description about quiet protests having little sway and gun owners just meekly accepting the gun control regimes that are handed down, because that's not what I've seen in California.
No, you're getting the whole come and take it mentality, the we will not comply mentality that you saw in Connecticut and New York. People are saying, you know, this, we're not going to obey this law. The problem is, and this, that article definitely overstates things, but, you know, I used to be a prosecutor. I've done criminal defense for years. I've seen lots of people accidentally run afoul of the law. I've seen lots of search warrants executed. There is this strategy, I think, among the gun ban lobby to obviously incrementally increase the severity of these laws. It's the boiling the frog approach, you know. Hopefully the gun owners that appreciate their right to keep and bear arms won't notice the minimal infringement until it's too late. That I think there's definitely an aspect of that strategy at play from the gun ban lobby, because that's what they are. Ultimately, they want to ban civilian possession of firearms. They think that would work or be good for other reasons. Certainly the state would then have unchallengeable power. But the article, to say that meekly turning things over and they have no power, I think that's a bit of an overstatement.
Well, particularly when it comes to the magazine ban, because as you and I had talked about a couple of weeks ago, It doesn't look like anybody was handing the magazines over. You know, and that was what gun owners had to do, right? They either had to turn the magazines over to law enforcement or they had to get rid of them somehow, get them out of the state of California. And you couldn't find any law enforcement agency that said, yeah, people are turning in their magazines. I mean, it just wasn't happening.
Yeah, I think the magazine ban is a very good example. That is a massive display of civil disobedience, perhaps the most massive in this country's history. But what would have happened if it did become a crime, the police would not have gone out en masse and issued search warrants to seize people's magazines. But as they turned up, whether it's because of, you know, you have a fire at your, for whatever reason, you have a law enforcement response at your house, no matter how benign, you know, your stereo is too loud at a party, and they see a magazine, that's when those magazines get confiscated. Or your neighbor turns you in, you know, it becomes a whole way to get revenge on somebody you don't like. You turn them in for having one of these magazines. And when one person is faced with police at the door coming to take their magazine, it's not the kind of thing that there's, you know, a physical resistance to typically. So when they break us down like that into individuals as opposed to a collective response as a civil rights movement that is fighting for our right to keep and bear arms, the individuals cave in. And then they're faced with the typical scenario. I was just going to say the typical scenario, people get arrested and they're faced with a felony prosecution or some kind of a serious prosecution. And then they have to consider whether or not they want to plea bargain something that allows them to keep their right to bear arms or go to jury trial and potentially lose their right to bear arms forever. And unfortunately, you just don't get huge protests outside the courthouse supporting folks that have been facing those kinds of dilemmas. I mean, I've seen it play out hundreds of times.
I'm sure that you have, and you're right. You know, typically you're going to have to get a lot of media attention in order for there to be public awareness for something like that to manifest itself. And you're not likely to get that, frankly, in California. And to that end, Chuck, I want to ask you about a carry provision. I saw NRA's Institute for Legislative Action had reported earlier this week that the bill in California that would have banned the open carry of unloaded firearms in unincorporated areas of counties in California, that's been placed on the suspense file. So it's not dead. They could bring it back. I think they have until September to bring it up. But I'm curious about that. You know, look, the legislature could pass this bill tomorrow if they wanted to. And I'm curious, is there some thinking, and this would require some speculation on your part, but I know that we've got the new challenge to California's carry regime encompassing the open carry and the concealed carry policies. Do you think that the lawmakers in Sacramento want to hang on to some scrap of an ability to carry a firearm, even unloaded openly in an unincorporated area, to say, aha, see, look, you can exercise the right to bear arms in our state?
I don't get that sense, frankly, and it is a bit surprising because that would be the smart move to preserve some little pocket, as the judges in the three-judge panel on Peruta called it, little pockets of freedom. And they expressly said those little pockets of freedom don't justify taking away the right in a broader sense from everyone. But it seems that their intent on just eliminating almost eliminating the ability to possess a firearm, whether concealed or unconcealed, in any forum other than, you know, inside your house and very limited outside forums like hunting or something. But even there, it's very limited. So I don't, you know, I think it shows their ideological devotion to the concept of banning as many guns from as many places, from as many people as possible, since they can't, because of Heller and McDonald, ban all handgun or all gun possession entirely. But they're gonna, under the guise of regulation, they're going to advance bans in all three of those categories and push it as far as they can. And hopefully now we are seeing a court, and maybe some other courts will join in rejecting what Thomas and Gorsuch called the distressing trend of the lower courts in treating the Second Amendment as a second-class right.
Let's hope. Again, we saw that strong decision by Judge Benitez in the magazine case, and I hope that we continue to see more opinions of that nature coming out of California. Chuck, as always, sir, it is great talk with you. Thank you for all of your efforts out there, and they are not going unappreciated around the country.
My pleasure, Cam.
We'll talk to you soon. Chuck Michelle, you can follow Chuck on Twitter at Michelle Lawyers and also online at michellelawyers.com. Chuck does a great job with webinars, putting out grassroots email alerts. You can sign up for his mailing list. Stay informed, because honestly, I know, and I hope that if there are California gun owners listening, that they don't feel this way. But I know that there are California gun owners out there who feel like they've been abandoned, who feel like the rest of the country doesn't care, has given up. I can assure you that that is not the case. And, you know, we are watching on a daily basis the latest fights coming out of California. And California is one of those battleground states where, you know, the legislature obviously stacked against gun owners. You've probably got a majority of California voters. I mean, definitely if you look back at the propositions last year that went before the voters, a majority of voters in the state hostile to the constitutional right to keep and bear arms. But that doesn't make the right less important. That makes the right more important to protect. That's why we're not going to give up on California. Now, when we come back after a quick timeout, Taylor McCarty joins us. Writing in the Washington Examiner says the Women's March is a hypocritical shot, or taking a hypocritical shot at the NRA. We'll talk about that with Taylor, so stick around. Much more Cam and Company coming right up.
Speaking with Ben Trout, he is the VP of Customer Service and Guest Experience with Bristol Motor Speedway. Ben, welcome to the program. I am so excited not just to talk to you, but to talk about the race. So let's talk about the race. What's the official name of the night race, Ben? Go ahead.
Hey, John. First of all, thanks for having us on today. And, yeah, of course, it is the ever popular Bass Pro Shops NRA night race right here at Bristol Motor Speedway. And it's going to be one wonderful time. It's on the bucket list of so many race fans out there.
Yeah, I know.
And it's that night race is just a wonderful sight to see.
It's a classic already. Bristol is just, you know, a great track in so many ways. And then as good as this all is, then you have Bass Pro Shops and the NRA involved in the night race. And then, as if that's not enough, let's talk a little bit first about the whole thing that's happening with Dale, with Junior. What's going on?
Yeah, so as we all learned, and it was really interesting because Dale Earnhardt Jr. made the announcement the Tuesday following our spring race, our Food City 500.
Right.
And he comes out and he tells the world that, hey, at the completion of the 2017 season, I'm going to hang him up.
Yeah, which
I'm going to retire.
Shocked a lot of people. It was big news everywhere when he made that announcement.
John, it was huge news, and it really has impacted the racing world. So for fans that have an affinity for not just Dale Jr. but the Earnhardt name and the impact that the Earnhardt name has made on racing throughout three generations, they'll get a chance to see Dale Jr. race not once but twice. He'll be racing in the Xfinity Series Food City 300 on Friday night. But then, of course, on Saturday night, it's the big show. It's the Bass Pro Shops NRA night race. And we'll see if Dale Jr. can dial it back to 2004 when he actually won that race here at Bristol Motor Speedway.
How great,
see if
Ben
he
is.
Can, yeah, if he can
great,
do it again.
Everyone's going to be rooting for him to win the race. So we're talking about the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. It's Saturday, August 19th, coming up, and also the other race you mentioned on Friday. That, well, because what I'm leading to, Ben, is you don't just want to come down for the race. A lot of people come down race week. There's so much stuff going on. Just give us an idea, paint a little picture, Ben, of all the stuff that happens around the race during race week.
Hey, John, words can't do it justice. So that's the unique thing about Bristol race week. And a lot of times that's how we refer to it. We don't refer to it as a race weekend. We literally here in the halls and even in our communication to race fans, we call it August race week. We actually have a full package of on-track action and some great off-track events. So really the on-track stuff starts on Wednesday, and we have two races, not just one, but we have two. We have the UNOH 200 Camping World Truck Series, and then the what's a really unique race to see is the Bush's Beans 150 NASCAR Wheel and Modified Series race all on Wednesday.
Right.
And so that, you know, we see people arrive here a week ahead of time, sometimes in some cases 2 weeks ahead of time. They get to, you know, the beautiful hills of northeast Tennessee. They go visit our lakes and streams, or they drive down to the Pigeon Forge, Sevierville area. Just a lot of wonderful things to do here within the area. And a lot of our fans make literally make vacation out of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right before you hit that back to school time,
yep.
We see a lot of families roll in and they camp out and just have a lot of fun.
So before we run out of time,
yeah.
So we have the races on Friday and Saturday, and then Thursday night is the annual Fitzgerald Peterbilt Transporter Parade. That is so cool. Take about 30 seconds to tell us what that is.
Yeah, it's great. It's about so there's a place called the Pinnacle out near Exit 74 on I-81. And all of the haulers, the multi-million-dollar haulers that travel the NASCAR, the actual cars around from track to track, we line them up about 10 miles away from the speedway, and they make a trip down Highway 11E, or as most people around here, we refer to it as Volunteer Parkway. And we do, from about four different locations, we shoot fireworks high above the haulers, and it has become a true Bristol tradition. And they will do that again on that Thursday night of race week.
Ben Trout, Bristol Motor Speedway. Get more information, call 423-BRISTOL or go to NRARaceTix.com, code B17NRA. Ben Trout, thank you so much. Look forward to seeing you race week. Thank you, sir.
Hey, thanks, and we'll talk to you soon.
Welcome back to Cam and Company, your first source for Second Amendment news and information. By the way, if you want your tickets for the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race coming up August 19th at the Bristol Motor Speedway, NRA Race Tix, T-I-X.com, and the promo code is B17NRA, all caps, B17NRA. Again, as you just heard, Dale Jr.'s last night race, maybe from all time at Bristol Motor Speedway, and you can be a part of it. We will see you there. I'm looking forward to heading down this weekend, actually, talking with some of the guys from the track and shooting some video. You'll see that coming up on Cam and Company before long. Also coming up next hour, Sean Maloney of Buckeye Firearms, member of the NRA's Board of Directors, talking about a recent op-ed of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, the anti-gunners in Ohio targeting the wrong people. We'll also talk about the latest update with the faster training for educators in Ohio. Right now, though, I want to welcome to the program, she's got a column at the Washington Examiner, conservative media strategist Taylor McCarty is with us. Taylor, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I am fantastic. I appreciate you coming on the program. So let's get it out of the way right up front. You are an NRA member. Is that correct?
I am. I was a member in college and signed up for a full membership this year.
You okay, so nobody forced you to be an NRA member, right? Just want to make sure.
Nobody forced me. I remember when I was an undergraduate student, the NRA University came to campus, and that's when I really became interested in it. Grew up with a family who hunted and that sort of thing, but never really took it into my own hands, and I became concerned with my own safety, especially on campus and moving to Washington, D.C. as a 21-year-old a few years ago. So, yeah, I wanted to take my safety into my own hands, and I thought an NRA membership did that.
All right. So you've got a piece at the Washington Examiner talking about the women's march and the protest against the NRA, which is scheduled for tomorrow. You say that the Facebook event for the march claims that the NRA is a, quote, direct endorsement of violence against women, and encourages activists to practice their First Amendment rights while demanding the NRA, quote, take down the recent irresponsible and dangerous advertisement videos from all social platforms immediately. You also note that they say that the movement will, quote, proudly and bravely continue to strive for the respect of the civil and human rights of all people. But you say that you don't feel like that respect is extended to people like you.
No, I'm not buying it. The original women's march the day after the inauguration made it clear that women with right of center values were not welcome to the march. And I, you know, the word feminist has become a very controversial term, but I refuse to let the left hijack it. So when people ask me if I'm a feminist, I say absolutely, but the Constitution reigns supreme, and part of the Constitution is my right to own a firearm.
You say the left clings to the tired, overused, and blatantly false narrative that the NRA promotes violence, and this is further reiterated by the Women's March organizers. You say what organizers either didn't realize or perhaps conveniently chose to forget was that their own supporters have done exactly what they accuse the NRA of doing. What exactly are you talking about, Taylor?
So the speakers at the Women March back in January had quite a record on hand. Donna Hilton, who is responsible for the kidnapping, rape, torture, and murder of a 64-year-old gay man in New York. Angela Davis, who not only was the head of the Communist Party in America for many years, was responsible for a violent courtroom takeover who led to the death of a California judge. And Madonna, probably most famously of the three, said at the march that she had often thought about blowing up the White House. So if they say that the NRA is the organization that's encouraging violence, they're completely hypocritical. It's wrong, and they're doing the exact same thing themselves.
You watched the video in question, I'm sure. Did you think that the video was advocating violence?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I think it was encouraging people who have had their rights infringed to know their rights, and there's nothing violent about it. I think they're just intimidated, and God forbid anyone disagree with them. So I think that's where a lot of the backlash came from, but they're incorrect to say that it incited violence or encouraged violence in any way.
Talking again with Taylor McCarty, media strategist and author of the column in the Washington Examiner, taking a look at the Women's March and the march on the NRA. You say it seems that the Women's March did manage to get one thing right. Marchers are well within the right to protest peacefully. Not only is it their constitutional right, but it should also be encouraged for the sake of fostering a diverse marketplace of ideas, which, by the way, I absolutely agree with. However, you say protesting must not come at the expense of silencing others. And, you know, I will say not just this event, Taylor, but really that seems to be, I think, one of the common sticking points that we see in the protests slash riots that are occurring across this country on at least a semi-regular basis. I'm a First Amendment absolutist. I can hear things that I disagree with all day long. And you know what? It may bother me. It may offend me. But I don't feel the need to try to shut down someone else's speech. That seems to be, though, where we are right now, right? If you don't like what somebody says, do your best to silence them.
I think that's unfortunately what it's come to, and the conservative movement needs to do a good job at pushing back at that. We need to, you know, peacefully disagree with people who we disagree with ideologically, but say, hey, I'll disagree with you all day long, but I'm going to defend your right to say it. So we haven't seen that extended as a courtesy from the left. I hope we can find some common ground and agree that while we disagree, you know, it's fine. That's fine. That's part of creating an open dialogue. So unfortunately, it's not something we're seeing very often, but I hope that can turn around quickly.
I hope that you're right, Taylor. And listen, I appreciate your writing, and I definitely appreciate you coming on the program today. It's good talking with you. Hope we get a chance to do this in the future.
You as well. Thanks for having me. Have a good one.
You bet. You too. Taylor McCarty, join us. So you can find Taylor on Twitter at Taylor McSquared. Also, TaylorMcCarty.com. Sean Maloney of Buckeye Firearms joining us next hour. Also, Lars Daleside of NRA's Institute for Legislative Action coming up in hour three. Stephen Cruiser of IJ Review as well. And well, we've got a lot of news stories to get to this afternoon, including one that almost made the deal of the day. But I got to tell you, we've got multiple deals already, so I had to leave this one out. But it's worth talking about. Boca Raton, Florida, Palm Beach Post. Shelley Singletary, he's an 18-year-old from Boca Raton. He is a standout football player, 18-year-old running back and defensive back who is considered a major college prospect. He was facing some charges after he pled guilty to forcibly removing Air Jordan sneakers from an 11-year-old boy and stealing his bicycle. He was apparently riding in a car back in January with three juveniles when they spotted the 11-year-old riding his bike. Along with one of the juveniles, Singletary allegedly pulled off the boy's sneakers and took his bike. One of the juveniles returned shortly after the robbery and warned the boy that he would face retaliation if police were called. The victim picked Singletary out of a police photo lineup. He was arrested by Boca Raton police January 30th there at the high school. Singletary, who will turn 19 in September, is entering his final season of eligibility, even though he's beginning the 11th grade academically. State rules allow students to participate in athletics until reaching the age limit of 19 years and 9 months. Fall football practice begins July 31st. There's a great amount of discussion in this newspaper article about whether or not Mr. Singletary will be participating in high school football in the fall, because, again, he is a major college prospect. To which, Cameron, I can't help but note, this young man is 19, and he's entering the junior year of high school.
It is a glaring part of the story, isn't it?
I mean, I would think that, you know, this to me is the best argument for either just scrapping college football and having minor league football that's, you know, the NFL development, NFLD or whatever.
Right.
But come on now. What, I mean, look, maybe this young man's going to turn it around, and maybe that, you know, there have been some legit reasons as to why he's 19 and he's just now entering his junior year of high school. But you can't tell me that there's not a student there at Boca Raton High School who's not going to take better advantage of a college scholarship than this young man.
I know. That's the frustrating part. And, as you know, we're both college football fans, but when you look at the other side of it and you see the decisions that go, some of the horrible decisions that go into it, yeah, you're right. Imagine the students who are watching this. It's hard.
I'm a college football fan, but I am also I'm a big fan of reforming higher education right now.
Yes.
I'm willing to lose some things that I love. Right? Absolutely. Yeah, I as much as I love college football, if we want to talk about a wholesale revamping of higher education, and that means college football goes away, I'm willing to talk about that. Because honestly, sometimes it seems like these big colleges right now exist for athletics and the trust funds, right?
And indoctrination.
That have been set up for the and the indoctrination. Yes, that's the third leg of the stool, I suppose. The actual education just seems to be lost there. But, a deal of the day, runner-up, Shelley Singletary down in Boca Raton, Florida. And the school is not saying, by the way, whether or not he is going to actually participate in the fall practices. They said that they had to wait until the process had been adjudicated. It has now been adjudicated. He will get, by the way, oh, I didn't tell you a sentence. He's worn an ankle monitor since his arrest January 30th, so he was credited with 190 days in jail, even though he's not been in jail. And he must complete 30 hours of community service. He also has to write a 500-word essay about what he has learned from the case. So I'm not even sure that counts for a slap on the wrist. I mean, that's a finger wave right there. That's all that is. Shelley Singletary, our runner-up for the deal of the day. There was also a fascinating story. You may have seen this picture at some point. The monkey selfie. Picture is several years old at this point, but PETA is trying to represent this monkey that took a selfie. Yeah, because it's PETA, and that's what they do. And this has actually gone to court. Ninth Circuit in San Francisco, of course it's the Ninth Circuit, right? At issue here is the British nature photographer David Slater, whose camera was used by the monkey to take the selfie. Slater included the photographs in a book called Wildlife Personalities. And PETA sued. They sued Peter Slater. They sued the San Francisco-based publishing company Blurb for copyright infringement. They sought a court order in 2015 allowing it to administer all proceeds from the photos taken in a wildlife reserve in Indonesia to benefit the monkey. Now, you might be wondering, how is it that PETA is representing the monkey? Did the monkey ask PETA to represent it in court? Did the monkey schedule a meeting with PETA's attorneys? What gives PETA the right to assume that it can speak for the monkey? And this is an actual legal question that is being raised here. In fact, that was one of the big questions that a judge had for PETA in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The judges grilled PETA's attorney on why PETA has status to represent the monkey named Naruto, and said that, quote, having genuine care for the animal is not enough to establish a next friend relationship, which is required to represent the monkey in court. CBS News quoted Angela Dunning, an attorney for Blurb, the self-publishing firm,
Wondering at the possibilities if they don't win. She said after the hearing, where does it end? If a monkey can sue for copyright infringement, what else can a monkey do? Well, not just... No. That's the wrong question. It's not what else can a monkey do, although PETA would assume that monkeys can do all kinds of things, legally speaking. But if a monkey can sue, could PETA sue representing, you know, the elephant or the arachnid or whatever else that had its picture taken without consent, right? I mean, this is not just a novel legal argument here. Could PETA sue on behalf of the deer harvested during deer season in states around the country? PETA's general counsel, Jeff Kerr, said PETA is, quote, clearly representing Naruto's best interest. No. Clearly, PETA's representing PETA's best interest, the best interest of the monkey. I imagine you'd have to speak monkey to find that out. All right, stick around. Hour two of Cam and Company, no monkeying around. We'll be right back right after this.
What this program will do is it will take you from somebody who has a gun and might have a gun on your hip to somebody who is proficient in using that gun.
I would say I'm still in the beginner's phase in a sense that I didn't really start doing any official training, going to classes, until about a year ago.
If I were to put it on a scale of 1 to 10 as far as proficiency, I would say I'm under 5. That will change because I have made that decision to become as proficient as possible.
With a handgun, I've got a lot more experience, and so I'm a little bit better shot. With a rifle, Caitlin is a better shot because of all the experience she has had.
I've been fortunate enough to do a lot of shooting and be in units that have done a lot of shooting. So when it comes to the legality of it, the responsibility of it, and when it comes to the actual physical training, I think it's awesome.
I have a lot of experience with firearms, but from high-level instructors, they just have infinite knowledge, and it's really nice to learn from people like them.
You know, I've done some classes before, but these guys really break it down into every little step so that you're able to really hone in every little movement.
They all have similar backgrounds, but the diversity in each of them and the stories and experiences they've all had are ideal for someone like myself to walk into this experience.
Oh my gosh, it's definitely a once-in-a-lifetime experience getting training from these amazing guys out here. Gotten so much more out of this than a couple weeks of shooting on my own.
There's things that I've done that are fast. There's things I've done that look good. There's things I've done that work in certain scenarios. These guys are teaching a way that works every time. The heavy burden that you carrying was where I learned the most.
The right responsibilities is probably one of the more important parts of what you can learn.
On the range and off the range, you know, just knowing what the laws are, how we need to think, the mindset that we need if you are carrying a gun, that it is a big responsibility.
A lot of that information was eye-opening to me, and I hadn't heard it instructed that way, I hadn't heard it presented that way, so it was very educational.
You can always go to the range and shoot at paper, but this class brought in different elements that you don't always do, like low-light shooting.
Statistically, things happen mostly after dark when you would need to use your firearm, and so that's a really important skill that I need to have.
With Airsoft, it really helped wrap the whole training experience together, brought the adrenaline level up, the realness of the scenario.
I think it's the best way to learn. I think you can tell somebody something so many times, and you can look at it on paper so many times, but until you get that real tactile response and that adrenaline and that situational scenario, there's no better way to learn.
When the whistle hit and Derek started running, when I pulled out my gun out of my holster and shot, you could see the distance that he got on me, and that's such a huge reality check. So as parents, this class is really great. The more tools that we have, you know, to protect our kids and our family, I think the better.
This program is great for everyone. I think it's great for someone like me that's carried a long time and had a lot of shooting experience. And I think it's great for someone that's coming in and this may be the only class they take.
Made in America since 1949.
family owned and operated. Legendary performance. This is Hornady. You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. It is Hour 2 of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, on the air right now here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. Talking this hour with Sean Maloney of the Buckeye Firearms Association, member of the NRA's Board of Directors, about that. I was shocked to see it. Pro-gun column at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Once again, the anti-gunners in Ohio targeting the wrong people. This is from Ted Dialyud, I believe is how you pronounce his last name, a member of the Cleveland Plain Dealers editorial board. Now, I did see today that the Cleveland Plain Dealer followed up that column with another column by a guy who used to be on the editorial board, I think from like 91 to 2003, who wrote his, and it's the anti-gun column that you would expect. Right. It's just the gun lobby and they're just rolling around and the profits that they're making off of selling these guns. I mean, it was that bad. But we'll talk about it with Sean Maloney a little bit later on in the hour. And I tell you what, I also want to take a look later in the hour. Kind of want to hone in on what's going on in the Twin Cities. The Minneapolis Star Tribune had a fascinating story today. We're going to talk with Sean in Ohio. One of the things I want to talk with Sean about is the FASTER training, the training for educators. Over 900 educators taught in Ohio, the vast majority of them Ohio educators, how to safely and responsibly use that firearm in defense of others if, God forbid, there ever is an active shooter situation at their school. We've seen dozens of school districts adopt these policies across the state of Ohio. Meanwhile, in St. Paul, Minnesota, they're talking about reducing the number of school resource officers there in these schools. Actually, not just in St. Paul, in Minneapolis as well, bringing down those numbers. And I saw a couple of statistics that were kind of shocking to me. So we'll talk about that. There's also a new art show taking place in Minneapolis. Star Tribune reporting artists taking aim at U.S. gun ownership in a Minneapolis gallery show. Yeah, how about that? It's the Suzanne Slavik's traveling exhibition called Unloaded. The show features 22 artists from across the country whose work discusses both the historic and social issues surrounding gun ownership. None of the perspectives, the Star Tribune says, presented in the show endorse the gun. On the one hand, it's nice of them to actually acknowledge that. On the other hand, I had absolutely no expectation that there would actually be a supporter of the right to keep and bear arms taking part in this traveling gallery exhibition. But that's nice. Anyway, we'll talk about that a little bit later on in this hour, kind of zoom in on what's going on there with the Twin Cities. But I want to talk about what's going on in Seattle right now. Seattle is a mess. They are an absolute mess. So, you know, Seattle passed its gun and ammo tax last year. The idea being that people buying firearms and ammunition in Seattle would pay a little bit extra money. The money would then be dedicated to a fund reduce gun violence or deal with the trauma of gun violence. And they had great plans for the, you know, millions of dollars that was going to be raised. And then they didn't raise millions of dollars. One of the, I think, two dedicated gun stores in Seattle has actually left Seattle. And I think business might be down at the other one, but they're not getting the tax revenues that they thought. Then Seattle thought, okay, you know what, we're going to have, we're going to help out the working class. We're going to raise up our minimum wage to $15 an hour. And this will benefit those folks who are having to work, you know, fast food jobs, low-level retail jobs. It'll help secure a living wage for them. Well, it hasn't done that. Study out shows that those workers have actually lost about $1,500 on average. And some have faced unemployment as small businesses in particular have been cutting hours. Maybe you're working now two jobs when you used to be able to work one just to earn the same amount of money. It's not worked out well. Seattle has recently decided to pass a tax on the wealthiest of Seattleans, Seattleites, who I guess will soon be leaving the city of Seattle, Karen, unless they pass an ordinance that forbids them from moving.
Escape from Seattle.
Right. Yeah, Mayor Pliskin, 2020, or wherever the next Seattle election is. And then there's this story from the Seattle Times, downtown Seattle. Judges complain that it's unsafe and unsanitary outside of the King County Courthouse in Seattle. Two King County Superior Court judges asking for help cleaning up the courthouse at 3rd Avenue and James Street after they say two jurors and half a dozen employees have been assaulted right outside of the courthouse in downtown Seattle. The judges Laura Invine and Jim Rogers acknowledged on Tuesday that there are difficult underlying circumstances contributing to the unsanitary and potentially frightening atmosphere around the courthouse. They, the Seattle Times says, along with King County Sheriff John Urquhart, also recognize that there are two elements at play, crime and the fear of crime, with the latter being just as likely to keep people away as the former. It's amazing to me, by the way, in this news story. Good God, are you listening to the excuses and the explanation making? Before you even get to the problems, you already know that the judges have, they've recognized this is a complicated issue. And the sheriff recognizes that, yes, there's fear of crime, and there's also crime, and that these are two underlying... I mean, like, okay, so what actually is going on here? What's actually taking place? Christine Claridge of the Seattle Times says, the nearby blocks host most of the city's homeless shelter beds and many of its social service outlets, which draw those who need help and the people who prey on them. That's nothing new, said Judge Jim Rogers. But for whatever reasons, the judges said, things have gotten worse over the past few years. And jurors and potential jurors report being afraid to go to the courthouse. The judges say that they're starting to hear from jurors who want to do their civic duty at the county superior courthouse in Kent because they don't want to go to the downtown courthouse. Not because it's inconvenient or out of the way, but because they think it's dangerous. Judge Rogers said in a Tuesday morning presentation to the Metropolitan King County Council's Committee on Government Accountability and Oversight, I've never seen it this bad. Judge Invine told the committee about two incidents, one in late May of this year, one in June, just last month, in which jurors were attacked in separate incidents outside of the courthouse's 3rd Avenue entrance. On other occasions, Judge Invine said, employees have been spat on, slammed against a wall, punched, and she said, although cleaning and patrolling the area immediately around the courthouse would not address some of the deep-seated issues faced by denizens of the space, it would send a signal that someone was paying attention. She and Judge Rogers asked the county to take immediate steps to clean up the courthouse with a daily power wash of the surrounding sidewalks, which the Seattle Times says reek of urine and excrement. They also asked the county empty trash cans more frequently, remove bus stop benches, remove tents from the adjoining park, and increase the presence of law enforcement, not just to arrest people, but to deter crime. It goes back to this sort of anti-broken windows policing mentality of go break some windows. And we're not going to sweat the small stuff. Right. So you've got a homeless encampment downtown Seattle with maybe the drunken and disorderly conduct that can sometimes come with that. Not a large police presence. It sounds again like there's some physical violence. But you know what? We have to keep in mind that these people are people and they didn't ask to be homeless and they didn't ask to be in that situation. And we're asked to sort of ignore the fact that crimes are being committed. You can have sympathy for the people who are there availing themselves of the social services or attempting to avail themselves of the social services that are nearby while recognizing that we still have laws in the society for a reason and that violating those laws with impunity typically doesn't lead to good societal outcomes, nor, by the way, does it lead to good outcomes for the individual because sooner or later you keep breaking the law with impunity and it's going to catch up with you. The police captain, Mike Teeter, commander of the West Precinct, said that the police patrol the area heavily now, and that while there are certainly people in crisis or need who behave in ways that may make others, quote, uncomfortable, there's often no criminal activity involved. He says statistically, a person is slightly less likely to be assaulted near the courthouse than in some other areas of the city. He also said the police are not able to address some of the things that may be intimidating to occasional visitors, such as seeing someone standing on the street corner and yelling. I said that what makes people uncomfortable, it's not a crime. Brian Wetzel, a Port Orchard resident who was passing through the neighborhood on his way to the airport, understood the concerns. He says the area, quote, seemed kind of seedy. But Renee Wingett, a, quote, permanent resident of the park, as the Seattle Times describes her, scoffed at the idea that the patch of land near the courthouse was any worse than anywhere else. She said the area may look a little rough at the edges, but, quote, there's nothing to be afraid of out here. The people who are afraid probably just haven't experienced homelessness, but experience is a great teacher. Well, I would think that the people who are afraid maybe have heard about the assaults on the jurors and the employees there at the courthouse. That would be my thinking. Seattle Times says some committee members expressed concern about addressing the symptoms of the area's problems without getting to the cause. Council member Larry Gossett said he didn't like the idea of power washing the sidewalks because it brought back images of the use of hoses against civil rights activists. Now think about that for a second. The reason why the judges requested that the sidewalks outside of the courthouse be power washed every day, they didn't say, look, we've got these homeless people who are just squatting out there on the sidewalk, and if we bring the hoses out, we can move them along. No, even as the Seattle Times reports, the sidewalks outside of the courthouse in downtown Seattle reek of urine and excrement. And the judges said, hey, you know, can we wash this down once a day so maybe it doesn't stink like it's an outdoor bathroom? But that's problematic. That is indicative, according to this committee member, of images of the use of hoses against civil rights activists. I don't know if that's grandstanding or if that's actually what the guy thinks. I don't know. But I know that that's a problem. When you can't even talk about, you know, cleaning the sidewalks with a hose, it's like bizarro world in Seattle. I mean, you can't even have a discussion about how do we make the area outside of our courthouse not reek of poop. Apparently, Cameron, I guess this guy's got a proposal, a giant 80-foot statue made of Febreze. I think that...
it's amazing.
Well, that's probably not biodegradable. That wouldn't fly.
I mean, it's depressing and amazing. Listen, as you read the story and as you've talked so much about the city of Seattle's law, their war on legal gun ownership and their mental gymnastics against crime. I mean, not to single out the entire population, but there's elements of that population that are committing crimes, apparently, obviously. But they go out of their way not to offend anybody. But legal gun owners are the problem. You want the, stay away from these people. We need to kick them out of our city. We can't even sell legal guns. But oh no, we can't clean up a population that's making it hard to accomplish our justice system. I mean, it's really depressing listening to this.
It is, and I don't think they've hit bottom yet. I mean, the end of the Seattle story says while no official action was taken, the county's administrative officer, Caroline Whalen, and the facilities manager assured committee members that a stepped-up schedule of power washing and garbage cleanup would begin immediately. So apparently they are going ahead with the power washing, despite the objection of that committee member. Though the judge said she was not confident the issue would remain at the top of the county's priorities, Judge Envine said that she was pleased with the outcome for now. She said, quote, we need to do everything we can to make this courthouse welcoming to all. So, the fact that this is even contentious, right, that you can't even recognize, okay, there's a problem. We've got people who are afraid to go down to the courthouse. They're afraid to do their civic duty. They're asking if they can serve their jury duty somewhere else because they feel like this place is just not safe. The area right outside of our courthouse has the impression of not being a safe place, and we need to do something about that. That's reality. Now, you can argue whether or not that impression is false or true. But if that's the reality, that people are now calling and saying, can I do my jury duty somewhere else? Because I don't want to come down there. That people are getting assaulted. you've got to be able to confront that reality. And that you can confront that reality, by the way, without coming to the conclusion that every homeless person in the downtown area is a threat or a danger to others. There's no reason why you have to come to that conclusion to say, okay, we need to do what we can to ensure that this is an area that is safe for all downtown. But yet, they can't get there. Any attempt to note that there is a problem immediately becomes an attack on the homeless population in downtown Seattle. And your classist or your whateverist for noting that there's a problem. That's a really good way for problems to get worse. It doesn't sound like these judges were necessarily shamed for bringing this up, but how long before that is the case? How long before someone who dares to mention, you know, someone got punched again yesterday, gets called out for revealing these inconvenient truths? All right, stick around. When we return here on Cam and Company, Sean Maloney, a Buckeye Farms Association member of the NRA's Board of Directors, joins us. We've got much more Cam and Company straight ahead, so stick around. We'll be right back right after this. Talking with Lieutenant Colonel Robert Ledee from the Armor for Troops Foundation. What is Armor for Troops all about? I mean, it sounds like it might be kind of self-explanatory, right?
We started this in 2005. We realized there was a lot of shortage of equipment overseas, so we started the foundation. We provide anti-ballistic eyewear, Under Armour, multifunction tools, knee pads, elbow pads, antibacterial clothing. You know, you don't, Marines and all military in the war zone don't shower for 2 or 3 weeks. At that point, only your mother will love you. But we provide equipment. We're doing boots, boot pads. We started doing some vests, but they got so expensive we couldn't do it anymore.
Wow, that's still an amazing amount of material that you all are able to supply free of charge to these members of the military.
The boxes we were standing in had a retail of $750 of all the stuff we put in it. In addition to all the equipment, we also put in batteries, toothpaste, toothbrush, disposable shavers, deodorant, clear eyes, lip thing. We had face wipes, hand wipes, foot powder. So we put a big box together.
That is fantastic. And this is all volunteer-driven?
Yes, it is. We have zero salaries. Everybody is a volunteer, have been for over 10 years, and no one gets paid anything here.
And how many people have you been able to help since 2005?
Well, we sent out over 46,000 pairs of eyewear alone. So you got to say we've helped over 46,000 people. Doesn't count the thousands of Under Armour and multifunction tools, etc.
That is incredible. Was there anything like this when you were active duty?
No. And I did 31 years in the Marine Corps. So because of what was happening, especially going to a war zone, I remember what Secretary Rumsfeld said. You go to war with what you have, not with what you want. So we started figuring out that there was a shortage of things. We were going to do something that no one else has done. The military did offer equipment. We just gave them better grade equipment.
Last summer, 5 Dallas law enforcement officers were killed while protecting hundreds of protesters who marched against America's police. My brother, Mike Kroll, was one of them. No protesters lost their lives. No media were hit by bullets. But Mike was there, protecting, serving, sacrificing, as he did every day for 8 years on the Dallas PD. The National Rifle Association honors such sacrifice. While the media paints our police as criminals and celebrities attack them, the NRA backs our blue. Now you can too. Donate your vehicles to NRA Cars for Freedom. Visit NRACarsForFreedom.com or call 1-866-NRA-GIFT. Donations are tax deductible and will help provide training for law enforcement. My brother gave his life protecting those who marched against him. That's why I back our blue. Stand with me. NRACarsForFreedom.com. 1-866-NRA-GIFT.
Wild turkey. Venison stew. Roasted pheasant. Rabbit risotto. The chemical-free, just-picked ingredients and the absence of antibiotics in the freshest of meats are the essence of today's farm-to-table food culture. But hunters have been eating this way for centuries. This is their table, and this is their farm. Trust the hunter in your blood.
This is the place. The place where you can forget all about work for a while and celebrate the good old U.S. of A. And take in the best bumper-banging, fist-waving, hero-making short track race of the year. The Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. And kids' tickets are just $10. Be there August 19th because it ain't just another race. It's Bristol, baby.
Thank you so much for joining us here on another edition of Cam and Company, NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. An hour from now, Lars Daleside from NRA ILA joins us right now. Sean Maloney with the Buckeye Firearms Association, member of the NRA's Board of Directors. He is with us on the program. Sean, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Cam. How are you?
I am fantastic. I appreciate you joining me. I was so excited yesterday to see this column of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Member of the editorial staff there, Ted Dialdid, with the column, once again, the anti-gunners in Ohio target the wrong people. Now, today, Sean, I have to tell you, my expectations for the Cleveland Plain Dealer were sort of brought back in check. They had a hugely anti-gun and anti-NRA column by a former member of the editorial board. But for a brief moment in time, it was nice to see some support for the Second Amendment from the pages of the state's largest newspaper.
You know what? You're right. When it comes from the Cleveland Plain Dealer, you know, certain members of Buckeye Farms Association, they were going to go check to see if hell froze over when this was put in there. And I just pointed out that you know, the tide is turning for all of us. And even the bobbleheads at the Cleveland Plain Dealer aren't so beholden to the publisher anymore because they realize that to believe what they've been trying to sell the rest of us is really to put themselves in danger also, because clearly – more guns equals less crime and more access we have to firearms has been proven over and over again in the state of Ohio, the safer and better off we all are. So it's good that something could come out like this from the Plain Dealer. And I think you understand how monumental this was.
Absolutely. You know, in the bill in question, can we talk about the bill? What exactly is what does this bill in question do, Sean?
It's House Bill 233 that's now in front of the Senate. Essentially, what it does is it simply decriminalizes the law-abiding concealed carry permit holder who's been trained and had a background check if they, by mistake or inadvertence, end up in a victim zone or a do-not-carry zone, like the lobby of some obscure government building. All of a sudden, they become a felon under current law. It's a fifth-degree felony, a year in jail, and a $2,500 fine. Now what this law does is it decriminalizes it and says, you know what, if by mistake or inadvertence you, the law-abiding concealed carry holder who submitted to a background check, if you end up in one of these places by mistake or inadvertence and they notice it, they ask you to leave. If you leave, there's no criminal penalty and it's over with. If you refuse to leave, then it's a disorderly conduct, and then you stay out of there for the next 30 days and there's no problem. But now if you go back again 15 days later, well, it becomes a crime now, punishable by 30 days in jail and a $250 fine. So it's just not giving people blanket permission to do these things. It's simply, if by mistake or inadvertence with no criminal intent and unintentionally doing something, I think the statute of limitations passed, so I'll make this admission. I probably went into my school district for 10 straight years for parent-teacher conferences armed because I totally forgot. I wear a firearm every day, and I had no idea that it was with me. And one day I was walking out, and I said to my wife, you know what? I'm carrying a gun this whole time. And it was – I totally never crossed my mind. And so I'm a person that would potentially benefit from that because I was a felon. And I'm an attorney and I was a felon, but I had no intent to do that. It just happened. And, you know, so by mistake or inadvertence, it's easy to have happen when you're so used to having your firearm that you really don't think about it.
Absolutely. All right. So this is House Bill 233. As you said, it's over before the Senate right now. Is it still in committee or has it made it out to the Senate floor yet, Sean?
It's in the Senate right now. We're going to be on a recess, so I don't expect anything much to happen probably until closer to the fall. But
okay.
It has wide support in both the House and the Senate, and it's just a common sense piece of legislation. Why turn law-abiding citizens into felons?
Well, it's a wonderful question, and I would love to hear some of the folks who say they believe in common sense gun safety regulations answer why they would like to see somebody with no ill intent turned into a felon. But, you know, in the meantime, this piece by Ted DeAudian at the Cleveland Plain Dealer said part of his column said you can already hear the screaming. Ohioans want to allow guns in schools. No, they don't, he says, although some guns in the hands of experienced and responsible adults might have prevented or at least mitigated several of the school tragedies the nation has experienced in recent years. Now, I realize this was, you know, a column in the print version. There's a finite amount of space available to the columnist, but we should talk a little bit about the faster training and the school districts across Ohio that have availed themselves of this training, because I saw Fox 45 in Ohio had a story yesterday. Local district training and arming teachers in case of school shooting. This was Mad River local schools who I guess sent a couple of dozen educators to faster training recently, and Fox 45 got to come along to do a little bit of filming. I mean, you know, this is happening right now in Ohio, Sean, and I have a feeling that there are a lot of anti-gun activists who are either unaware that this is taking place, or maybe don't want to even to admit that this is happening.
You know, it could be a number of things, but really, how do you argue against protecting your children and your schools, doing everything you possibly can to protect them? I mean, Mad River was a great class. They used their schools for part of the force-on-force training. They had a range nearby, and Buckeye Firearms and TDI came to them, and we conducted some great training again. And they decided to jump in with both feet. They thought about it long and hard, and it was something that they wanted to do, and it really wasn't done in secret. They let the whole world know immediately that we're going to arm our teachers. And I think basically it's so widespread now in the state of Ohio. It's spread to Colorado. It's going to be in Pennsylvania. People understand really and truly that, you know what, the only way for us to protect our children is to make sure we have someone who can immediately stop the threat, render first aid, and be the first responders that, you know, that 2, 3, 5, 10 minutes down the road, maybe they're going to show up. And that's just too much time. So I think over and over again, and you've said it before, the tide is turning. People are starting to understand. And really, how can you argue against doing everything you possibly can to protect our most precious resource, you know, our children?
Absolutely. And I know that Joe Eden, who's the program director of the Faster Save Lives program, told Fox 45, we've trained just about 900 school staff from 192 school districts. He said that's across 8 states, but the vast majority from right there in Ohio. You know, I'm kind of surprised by that figure, Sean. And I got to say, I mean, you guys have been doing this for a couple of years now with a little bit of media attention. You're starting to get more of it. But has it been a benefit to you, you think, that you've been able to do this without the media spotlight and the media scrutiny? Has that allowed this program to sort of grow some legs and take off organically?
You know, from the beginning, I think we all were concerned about that. What would the media do? We are very stingy with the amount of media coverage that we would allow, certainly during our classes. But we found that when most of us found out about it, when their moms and dads realized it was happening and it was at the school district next door, they said, you know what? We want this too. So at first I thought it was going to be a double-edged sword, but more and more as the media got involved, it spread the world in a good way. And I think, you know, I've watched Laura Carno here enough to know that she blew the top off media in Colorado. And that's nothing but good. And what's coming out of that helps us in Ohio. And I know it's going to do wonders for her in Colorado. So, you know, the more the word is spreading, the more the FASTER program is spreading. We have people coming in and asking to come in from states throughout the United States all the time. And it's nice to have the ability to offer them this training and to make sure they take a look at it. And some of them have training programs in place, but they want to do what the rest of us want to do. They want to make it better, and they want to offer the best training possible. I mean, how can someone say no to good training?
It's a great question. And you know, and it's interesting, too. I mean, this piece at Fox 45, not one critic quoted. I don't know if they went looking and couldn't find anybody who wanted to go on camera, if that just wasn't the direction they wanted to take the piece. They wanted to make it more about the training itself. But I did find that interesting that there was not one person in that story who would go on record and say, oh, this is a horrible idea.
Well, you know, for the most part, there's very few people left in the state of Ohio that come out and are willing to make statements like that, especially against the faster training program. And I think really and truly that they realize that this is the best thing. And again, it's hard to be a critic of something that's been proving itself so well for over 5 years now and is spreading throughout the country. Again, how can you talk anybody out of not protecting your children? And I think people realize that. And I expected to see some naysayers from time to time. But the longer this program has went on, the more time I spend in front of school districts and school boards, the less opposition there seems to be. I think the tide is turning and it's starting to be the new normal. You know, unfortunately, we live in a broken world. We're faced with terrorism. We're faced with anybody entering a school and attacking our children just for nothing more than body counts. And some of them have other motives in place. And I think we as Americans have started to think what's happening in our own backyard now. And many of us thought it would never happen. And now that we know that it will, I think we're starting to come around as a people and deciding we need to do whatever we possibly can to stop the threats and to make America just a safe country and a place where our kids can go to school without fears.
Sean Maloney, it is always good talking with you, sir. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good talking to you.
You bet. Sean Maloney on Twitter at Sean Maloney NRA with Buckeye Firearms and member of the NRA's board of directors. And you know, Sean, talking about the fact we live in a broken world, right? We live in a world where there are problems. We live in a world where there is crime, where there is temptation, there are drugs. The New York Times Magazine, Benjamin Rocklin has a piece. It'll be, I guess, in print this weekend, but it's online right now. Talking about a guy in Laconia, New Hampshire, who is trying to make the broken world a little bit better. Eric Adams is with the Laconia Police Department. And he is basically a one-man task force in Laconia. Now, New Hampshire, one of the many states around the country that has been hit hard by the heroin and opioid epidemic, as Benjamin Rocklin says, of the 13 states with the highest death rates from drug overdoses, five are in New England. New Hampshire, in particular, has more per capita overdose deaths than anywhere but West Virginia. In 2012, there were 163 drug overdose deaths in New Hampshire. By 2015, the state had nearly 500 overdose deaths. In just 3 years, from 163 to almost 500. In Manchester, New Hampshire, largest city in the state, police seized more than 27,000 grams of heroin last year, up from 1,314 grams a year earlier. He writes, in certain neighborhoods, a single dose of heroin can cost less than a six-pack of Bud. Waiting lists for treatment programs can stretch as long as 8 weeks. And this officer there in Laconia, New Hampshire, Eric Adams, he had started out his career as a corrections officer, then moved into policing. He said so many of the drug users that he saw had made one bad decision and became chained to it, or they began on a valid prescription for pain medication after an injury and then grew addicted. When refills grew scarce, they turned to alternatives, many no longer even using to get high, only to avoid the agony withdrawal. They were teenaged, middle-aged, elderly. There were students, there were bankers, there were grocery clerks, there were businesswomen with six-figure salaries, homeless men with shopping carts. He said, you know, we're arresting these people, and then they'd get out, and the cycle would start all over again. He said, we're not getting anywhere. And he told this to his chief, Christopher Adams. And the chief said, you're right. We're really not getting anywhere. So they sat down, and they started thinking, okay, well, what can we do? Not, you know, what can we, the United States, do, or what can we, the state of New Hampshire, do, but what can we in the Laconia Police Department do for the people that we're serving, for our community? What can we do to try to make this epidemic better, to try to bring these numbers down? Chief Adams says he told a couple of years ago he couldn't remember ever hearing of a heroin case in Laconia. He said now it's every day. He said it's a majority, not just in Laconia, it's all over. So they came up with three different approaches that are not mutually exclusive to one another. Prevention, enforcement, and treatment. As the New York Times Magazine says, to accomplish all three would mean regarding drug users and misusers as not only criminals, they were also customers who were being targeted and sold to. They were also victims who needed medical treatment. To coordinate all those approaches would require a particular sort of officer. So Eric Adams, in September of 2014, became the department's prevention, enforcement, and treatment coordinator. And he says he thought at the time this was going to be great. It was going to be, you know, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. He's going to have weekends off. He thought he'd be able to spend more time at home with his wife and kids, and that didn't happen. But it's okay. It appears to actually be making a difference in Laconia. And it doesn't involve, again, a huge number of government grants. It doesn't involve any new laws on the books. What it involves and what it takes is someone who is dedicated to making a difference. And it sounds like with Eric Adams, they found somebody who is dedicated to making a difference here. In 2014, the year he began working on this job, Laconia, New Hampshire had 10 opioid fatalities. 2016, the number was 5. So that's good. That's cut in half. 51 of its residents volunteered for treatment last year, up from 46 a year before, and 14 a year before that. Of the 204 addicts that Adams has crossed paths with, 123 of them, or 60%, have agreed to keep in touch. Adams calls them at least weekly. 92 have entered clinical treatment. 84 are in recovery. 0 have died. That's a pretty good number. Now, listen, Eric Adams will be the first to tell you this is not going to fix everything. In fact, in that article, he talks about how one of the hardest things for him was simply accepting the fact that he is not going to be able to save everyone. There are going to be people that he meets, that he reaches out to, that he engages with, who he will extend help to, and they'll turn it down. And they will not admit that they have a problem. And they may very well die because of it. You can't save everybody, he says. But you can save some people. And you can make a difference. You just got to try. So I thought that this story was worth highlighting. Because I think if we're going to be treating, whether it's the opioid epidemic, whether it's violent crime in places like Baltimore or Chicago, again, the answer is not going to come with a big sweeping federal piece of legislation. It's not. The legislation, the more gun control laws aimed at law-abiding gun owners is not going to reduce violent crime. More sweeping legislation aimed at tackling the opioid epidemic, I don't think is necessarily going to reach out to these individual communities that are suffering through this epidemic. It takes that real grassroots local effort, sometimes, again, just from a handful of individuals who are in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, and have the tools necessary to do so, including the dedication. So I know we do our Good Guy of the Day story in Hour 3, but a tip of the cap, a surprising tip of the cap, but again, credit where credit's due, a good article about a great guy in Laconia, New Hampshire, Eric Adams, doing his part to try to stop the opioid epidemic there. All right, when we come back, we're going to turn our attention to the Twin Cities as hundreds of educators in Ohio getting trained on how to use firearms for defense of students if necessary. You've got school districts in Minneapolis and St. Paul that are trying to get rid of some of these school resource officers that are currently there to protect students. We'll talk about that and more right after a quick break. So stick around. Much more Camp and Company coming up next.
I'm here with Christina Krawczyk with NRA Foundation, Anthony Brewer with Greystone Marketing, and his nephew, Glenn Brewer. Thanks for being with us here. And Christina, we're talking about NRA Foundation. Let's start with you. Why is NRA Foundation so important? What does it do and how do you do it?
The NRA Foundation supports NRA programs and on local, state, and national programs. So like Women on Target, Eddie Eagle, School Shield, YHEC, Youth Education Summit. That money is produced with the foundation, and the blockbuster fundraiser behind that is Friends of NRA. So Friends of NRA has been around for 25 years. It's a milestone year.
Powerhouse.
At Powerhouse, blockbuster, we've got 53 field reps that produce over 1,100 events across the country. They raise about $65 million a year. Now, this is a milestone year, 25 years. So in that time, we've raised almost $750 million to support programs. So it's
amazing.
Incredible, really incredible.
All right. So and a lot of that happens with, you know, auctions, fundraisers, things like that. And I know people, they work tirelessly around the country to do these type of events. And we have with us Anthony Brewer with Greystone Marketing. So tell us a little bit about Anthony and what he did.
So, and you're exactly right. It takes like 15,000 volunteers across the country to put these on. So this year, we always have like a big sponsor showcase item. And this year, Diamondback Airboats produced this incredible airboat, the Diamondback NRA Airboat.
Oh.
What they wanted to do is kind of produce something that was an adventure and looked like a stealth airplane. So we've had that on Gun Broker for several weeks to raise money again for the foundation and the future of the shooting sports. And Anthony is our huge high bidder. He's wonderful. He loves the foundation, what it stands for, the cause, and we are just so thrilled to have him. And I know he's excited to get on that airboat.
Anthony, thank you so much. Why was it important to do what you did to bid on this airboat for the foundation?
Well, the airboat itself was built less than 30 miles from our home, from our office. So the synergy was there. Absolutely. I know nothing about airboats. I've never been on an airboat. But Bob from...
I bet you're going to now.
Absolutely. Bob,
it just looked cool.
Well, it looks cool, but Bob from Diamondback bent over backwards to accommodate the throughout the building process. We had our eye on it from when first time we heard about it.
Wow.
And what we want to do with it is utilize it for future opportunities for the NRA Foundation, not only to raise more funds, but safety awareness. Where Central Florida is, you know, it's Gator Country. So, you know, what better way than to, you know, come up with some NRA opportunities and hunts for the future generations. And, you know,
awesome.
There's a lot of different opportunities out there. So it's important that way.
And Glenn, I bet you can't wait to get on that boat.
I can't wait.
Are you going to be the pilot? Who's going to drive the airboat?
All I'm going to do is I'm just going to ride it. Just enjoy the breeze.
Ride it and go after the gators. All right, so we know, you know, the boat's cool and it's awesome, but there's more than that there, Anthony. You know, supporting, why it's so important that you supported the NRA Foundation. You know, because it's not, that's a lot of money, let's be honest.
It's a lot of money, but it transcends just our freedoms and our Second Amendment and our support and, you know, the monumental feat that was accomplished in November. Now it's time to look forward to education and opportunity for, you know, what NRA does with the Boy Scouts and the educational and the safety and gun awareness. My nephew just turned 18, and this is a big opportunity for him to embrace what the NRA does beyond just, you know, Second Amendment. I mean, that's one of our most important fundamental opportunities. But
so what do you like about being able to shoot and to hunt and all that kind of stuff, Glenn?
Honestly, when I have the firearm, it just teaches me the right way to use it and safety and knowing how to operate it.
It's cool, right? And I tell people that the shooting sports and hunting, there's so much more than just being a good shot. You learn that. You learn safety. You learn discipline. You learn so many things. There's you know, so many different benefits to it. All right, Christina, back to you.
Yes.
How do we get more information about the NRA Foundation and your very important work?
NRAfoundation.org. Everything that you need to find out. You're looking for grants, information about how you can raise money and donate to the cause. NRAfoundation.org, or you can follow us on Facebook.
Christina Krawczyk, Anthony Brewer, Glenn Brewer, thank you all for supporting the NRA Foundation, and thanks for being on NRA TV.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome back to Cam and Company, top of the hour, hero of the day, deal of the day. Good guy as well. Plus, next hour, Lars Daleside joins from NRA ILA. And we'll also finish off today's program talking with our friend Stephen Cruiser from IJ Review. Right now, though, let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, Minnesota. So we're just talking not long ago with Sean Maloney about the FASTER program. Again, over 900 educators trained in Ohio. We know that FASTER has moved into Colorado as well, and Pennsylvania, considering a bill that would allow school districts to decide for themselves if they wanted to have armed, trained staff there as a last defense against an active shooter situation. Meanwhile, the Star Tribune in Minneapolis reporting that Minneapolis Public Schools officials on Tuesday night outlined a contract that would shrink the number of Minneapolis Police Department officers in schools from 16 down to 14. So a minor reduction. The idea, they say, faces a school board vote in August. Superintendent Ed Graff says it's a plan that, quote, offers the welcoming and safe environment that all of our students and staff deserve. The Minneapolis schools surveyed almost 7,000 students, 700 staff, and 600 parents, and the majority in each group said that school resource officers should be in schools, adding that school resource officers make them feel safe in buildings. So why get rid of them? Well, according to the Minneapolis Tribune, almost half of these students surveyed said that they wished to reduce the time that school resource officers would spend in their schools. So the new plan, which would, again, provide for 14 officers, will cost the district $1.15 million for the coming school year. You know, this is interesting. We talk about there are all kinds of objections. One of the most common objections to the idea of teachers having that ability of being armed is, well, just hire a cop. Just put a cop in the schools. But the St. Paul School District also going to consider a proposal next month to reduce the number of school resource officers. They have nine, just nine school resource officers for the entire St. Paul School District. They want to reduce it down to 17. That would drop the district's costs from $884,499 down to about $700,000 just for seven school resource officers. Now, frankly, again, I'm surprised that a school district the size of St. Paul's has only seven school resource officers. But, you know, you take a look at these smaller districts, many of them rural districts, that are actually undertaking this training. If you've got, and I'll give you an example, typically in Virginia right now, in some of the rural areas, you've got, which has occurred over the last 10 years, you've had this sort of consolidation. So a lot of rural counties now, they don't have individual elementary schools. You've got a county primary school slash elementary school, a county middle school, and a county high school, maybe a county preschool as well. So 3 to 4 school buildings. Imagine trying to staff every one of those. Now, you can maybe get away with, you got 4 school resource officers, right? Then you're going to have at least one reserve or a floating officer who could, report if the school resource officer calls in sick at one of the schools. You might even want to have 2 to cover vacations and things like that. So you're looking at, even for a rural school district, to have just one school resource officer on site. What, 6 school resource officers? If St. Paul's paying 7 school resource officers and it's costing $700,000 a year, I just don't see how these rural school districts can afford that. Now, you might want to double up. Let's say a school resource officer can cover the high school and the middle school. Even if they're 2 separate campuses, maybe they're nearby, maybe you can double up on coverage. But, again, it's not going to be financially feasible for a lot of these small districts around the country to do this. So they're dropping the number of school resource officers, looks like, in Minneapolis and St. Paul. What's fascinating
is that St. Paul has had a lot of problems in the schools. There was a story in City Journal back in the winter of this year. Catherine Kirsten was the author. No Thug Left Behind. St. Paul Schools Abandoned Discipline and Unleashed Mayhem, she says. And she talks about the superintendent of St. Paul Public Schools, Valeria Silva, who assumed the position in December of 2009 and basically decided that she was going to eliminate what she called the, quote, punishment mentality in an effort to cut black discipline referrals. She lowered behavior expectations, dropped penalties for student misconduct. In 2012, the district removed, quote, continual willful disobedience as a suspendable offense. Silva also adopted a new protocol in interactions between schools and the police. The protocol ranked student offenses on five levels and required schools to report only the worst, including arson, aggravated assault, and firearm possession to police. School officials were encouraged to handle other serious offenses, such as assault, sexual violence, and drug possession, on their own. For a time, City Journal says, the district administration actually tied principals' bonuses to their track record on reducing discipline referrals. Well, they got their wish. I mean, the discipline referrals went down in 2011, 2012. Disorderly conduct charges for district students dropped 38%. School-based offenses referred to the Ramsey County Attorney's Office for charges also dropped in 2006. School officials made 875 referrals for misdemeanor and felony offenses. By 2011, they had made 538. Numbers have continued to fall since then. The question, though, is has the actual number of offenses dropped, or have the numbers of reported offenses dropped? Has the situation gotten better or worse? City Journal said at the city's high schools, as the 2015-2016 school year began, teachers stood by helplessly as rowdy packs of kids who came to school for free breakfast, lunch, and Wi-Fi rampaged through the hallways. Classroom invasions by students settling private quarrels or taking revenge for drug deals gone bad became routine. City pages in the Twin Cities reported students who tire of lectures simply stand up and leave. They hammer into rooms where they don't belong, inflicting mischief and malice on their peers. First few months of the school year witnessed riots or brawls at Como Park, Central, Humboldt, and Harding High Schools, including six fights in 3 days at Como Park. Police had to use chemical irritants to disperse battling students. A St. Paul police spokesman, Steve Linders, said, "We are seeing more violence and more serious violence. Fights at schools that might have been between two individuals are going into fights between several individuals, or even melees involving up to 50 people. In September, a massive brawl erupted at Como Park High School. Police had to call for backup," Linders said, "as the scene, quote, became very chaotic with many people fighting. These are not a couple of individuals squaring off with the intent of solving their private dispute," teacher Roy Magnuson told the Pioneer Press. He said, "These kids are trying to outnumber and attack." In October of 2015, 30 to 40 students clashed in a stairwell at Humboldt High School. Police tried to break up the brawl. A staff strained to hold the door closed to prevent dozens of students from forcing their way through to join the fight. And it got worse. City Journal reports teachers suffered injuries while resisting classroom invasions or intervening in fights. Police were compelled to taser a disruptive student. One teen brought a loaded gun to school, saying he needed to defend himself against rival gang members. At Harding High School, teacher Becky McQueen, who had been threatened with death and shoved into a shelf by students who weren't supposed to be in her class but came in, told City Pages that to keep out invaders, she now asks her students to use a, quote, secret knock to enter her classroom. The response by the district, apparently, according to City Journal, Silva's administration, points the blame on adults, the district's chief engagement officer, which I didn't even realize was a title. What do you do, Cameron? What's your master's in to become a chief engagement officer?
Parks and Rec.
I'm going to say leisure studies, leisure, I guess. Studies. But
right.
Yeah, the district would consider more training for staff and school resource officers on, quote, how to appropriately de-escalate situations. Fights might not have escalated, she said, quote, if some of the adults would have reacted differently. It's the teacher's fault. It's the school resource officer's fault for these fights escalating into brawls involving dozens of people. Asked if students should be expelled for fighting, Jackie Turner, the district's chief engagement officer, replied, you're not going to hear that from me. You're not going to hear that from the superintendent. You're not going to hear that from any of the administrators, or the students should be expelled for fighting. Meanwhile, City Journal says at many elementary schools, anarchy reigned. Students routinely spewed obscenities. This is elementary schools. Pummeled classmates, raced screaming through the halls. That according to a 2015 Pioneer Press article. Elementary school teachers risked physical dangers. Teacher Donna Wu caught in a fight between two fifth grade girls, knocked on the ground with a concussion. Fourth grade aide Sean Kelly told City Pages, I've been punched and kicked and spit on and called every cuss word you could possibly think of by elementary school students. Now, just out of curiosity, does this sound like the situation where you need fewer school resource officers? Where you want to cut the number of school resource officers? I'm kind of thinking maybe you need a few more school resource officers there. Deona Griffin is a parent, had a second grader at Battle Creek Elementary School. She said, my second grader's class is the most dysfunctional classroom I've ever witnessed with my own two eyes. I've never even heard of classrooms like her kid's classroom. The teacher, she said, has maybe six extreme behavior students in one class. I've seen them punch her. I've seen them walk around the halls. I've seen her try to read to the class, and it took her an hour and a half to read two pages. It's too much. David McGill, who's a science teacher at Capitol Hill Gifted and Talented Magnet School, told a school board that a fourth grade bully had, quote, significantly compromised an entire year of science instruction for his fellow students, but had no discipline whatsoever. One teacher said, many of us often go home in tears. Well, St. Paul Schools making their move to de-escalate the number of school resource officers. I bet that's going to make the teachers feel better. Stick around. Hour three of Cam and Company is coming up right after this.
This is a very unique race here, the Bass Pro NRA 500 here in Bristol. Give you a little feel for Bristol. You go around it in about 15 and a half seconds. And you got 40 cars on a half-mile racetrack. It's really, really tight.
Even though it's a tight racing and rough racing, you got to be patient. You can't tear your car up too early. You got to be able to be around at the end.
Things happen so fast, and that's what makes it just an awesome place to be, because there's action all over the track for the fans to watch and see.
Our fans, you will not find a more patriotic sport than NASCAR. These fans love our freedom, our Second Amendment, our Constitution, our liberty. That's what this country was built on. That's the kind of people that our fans are, our drivers. And it just gives me great honor to be here.
What makes Bristol so special is this is the last great Coliseum. And you can tell by when you first walk in this place, if you look up and you're surrounded by fans, the track is so banked and you're right on top of the action.
I came to Bristol probably in 1969 for the first race. Probably had 10 to 15,000 seats in the grandstand. There's an old guardrail around it. People sat on the grass banks in the back of it. And it was asphalt. And today, the track holds 160,000 people. It's the last great Coliseum, I guess you would want to call it. It builds so much energy for the fans. It builds so much energy for the drivers and pit crews. So it has something very special about it. That's why I say it's Bristol, baby.
Things just happen quicker here. You know, you got to stay in the race to win the race.
It's real tight racing. It's bumper to bumper, and you got to move people and make things happen.
As a driver, I had a lot of fun. Some of my best finishes were here. You know, Austin Dillon and Ty Dillon are grandsons, and they both race in NASCAR. As a car owner, I've had cars to finish 1, 2, 3, won the race, finish second, third.
And we've also, as a car owner, loaded three of them on the rollback and took them home. So it can go either way. It's feast or famine at Bristol. Now I look back and think how it was on my daughter and my wife when I was driving. So I guess I'm getting payback for whatever you say.
You know, I had put myself in a good position, and it sucks for Ty. He had such a good run going, and the moves he was making were really impressive. And we just kind of let the race come to us. We had a good car all night, a third and fourth place car. And when it all said and done and everything played out, we were the car to win. So it was a bummer for him, but I'm glad we're in victory lane. Go up that hill, I get to do a burnout on the way up. You know, all the history that's taking place here and to be a part of it is special.
We'll take it any way we can get it. We love these fans here at Bristol. They were cheering loud over there as the front stretch was burning it down. Hopefully we can do something like this come tomorrow night. Love this place, and I want to get as many fans as we can in here.
NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour three of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady. It starts right this second here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125, coming to you from the peaceful streets of Farmville, Virginia. I'm guessing the streets are still going to be peaceful here in Farmville, Virginia tomorrow. I know that the anti-gun activists are supposed to be holding a protest march from, I guess they're supposed to assemble outside of the NRA headquarters and then march 17 miles to the Department of Justice. What's the high supposed to be in Northern Virginia tomorrow, Cameron? 97, 98,
something like that? I just saw the post saying today's the hottest day in D.C. so far. It was like 100, and I expect the same thing tomorrow. And it's going to be quite interesting to see because for people who don't know the geography, the way to get from the NRA to D.C. is via a major highway, unless you want to take smaller highways and back roads. But that would take even longer in this heat. So I saw something that said they're not making the march the route public. But I can't imagine they're going to – it's called 66. I can't imagine they're on 66 with a police escort. So it's going to take a long time.
Yeah. I think maybe the reason why they're not making that march public is because it's going to involve a lot of Uber, I'm guessing.
exactly.
But, that's just me.
Direct billet to George Soros, please.
Yeah. I think Bloomberg is going to get that bill. Anyway, I'm guessing that the sidewalks outside of the NRA TV studios here in Farmville, Virginia, probably going to be pretty sleepy tomorrow morning. But I'm bringing donuts just in case there are any protesters that show up. We can, I was going to say break bread, but I guess it would be break donuts together, and then you can. And I wouldn't recommend walking up to Fairfax from Farmville. That's like 150 something miles. That's a lot. But if they do take the back roads, they probably have more shade. Might be a couple of degrees cooler than if they walked up 66, which I don't know. I'm sure Governor McAuliffe would bend over backwards to provide whatever they needed. You know, that's pretty much guaranteed to happen. Meanwhile, Dana Lash says that her show tomorrow, which is 1 to 4 Eastern time, noon to 3 Central, going to be a special protest edition of the Dana Lash Show. We'll be talking a little bit about it, I'm sure, on tomorrow's program as well. Right now, though, let's get to today's hero of the day, our deal of the day, and our good guy today. Hero of the day, brought to you by AdCorp Defense from the Houston Herald in Texas. Home invasion on Wednesday night in Licking, Texas, has been ruled self-defense against an aggressive home invader, according to Texas County Sheriff James Sigman. I'm sorry, I said this was state of Texas. This is Texas County, Missouri, in Licking, Missouri. Sheriff Sigman says a 34-year-old man said a 28-year-old man was attempting to break into his home while cursing and challenging the homeowner. Man forced his way into the home. The homeowner fired one shot from his pistol. Man said he was unsure if the bullet struck the person. Licking Police Chief Scott Lindsay said his department called out a little bit after 9 p.m. on Wednesday, where a man had a gunshot wound to the abdomen. It was the home invader. He was taken to the Texas County Memorial Hospital. Sheriff Sigman says after investigating the scene and questioning witnesses, it was determined that this shooting was an act of self-defense. So we
I don't know all of the details there, but the homeowner in Licking, Missouri, not facing any charges, acting in self-defense against a home invader, and is today's hero of the day. Now, our deal of the day. I've got several. I really tried hard to narrow this down, but I couldn't. So we're going to start with a story out of the Post-Bulletin of Connecticut. Assault of pregnant woman ends with probation. Dana Charles Gostomczyk, 38 years of age, originally charged with one count of first-degree aggravated tampering with a witness, one count of domestic assault by strangulation, and two counts of fifth-degree drug possession, all felonies, as well as one count of misdemeanor fifth-degree assault. Guess what happened? He got to plea bargain those charges down. Pleaded guilty in April to the domestic assault charge and one of the drug charges in exchange for the plea. The remaining counts dismissed at a hearing recently. Gostomczyk sentenced on the strangulation charge to 3 days in jail. 3 days. Oh, he was given credit for 3 days already served, and he was placed on probation for 3 years. Olmsted County District Court Judge Pamela King also ordered him to complete outpatient treatment and domestic abuse counseling and treatment. He was given a stay of imposition on that count. If he completes all of his conditions during the probationary period, the offense may be reduced in his record from a felony down to a misdemeanor. The investigation began back on November 18th when Rochester police sent to a home for a report of a domestic assault. They were greeted by a visibly pregnant woman who said that Gostomczyk had struggled with methamphetamine addiction for years, had recently relapsed, had missed work that day. The two argued, and Gostomczyk allegedly punched her 4 or 5 times on the top of the leg as she sat beside him. When she stood up to leave, he slapped her several times across the face. He began throwing stuff around the kitchen. The woman was about to leave the house when he reportedly grabbed her by the hair, pushed her down onto a sofa, got on top of her, began choking her, telling her several times that he would kill her if she called the police. 3 days in jail. 3 days in jail. That's it. Oh, sure, he's got probation. If he doesn't abide by the terms of his probation, then the hammer's going to fall down. Do you believe that? I don't believe that. Gostomczyk arrested the next day at his home, declined to answer any questions. According to the complaint, deputies who searched him found 3 small plastic bags containing powder in his pants pocket. One allegedly tested positive for cocaine, another for meth. A third substance couldn't be identified through field testing. 3 days. That's what Mr. Gostomczyk got. So deal of the day number one. Second deal of the day from the Baltimore Sun. A little bit different story. Teen who smashed traffic cone through car window during 2015 unrest returns to prison for violating probation. That's the headline from the Baltimore Sun. You may remember the Baltimore Sun calls one of the indelible images of the 2015 Baltimore unrest. Alan Bullock smashing a traffic cone through a car windshield. Bullock got a 4-year sentence recently for violating his probation on the riot charge. He's now 20 years of age. He violated his probation, apparently, when he failed to make court appearances, failed to meet with his probation officer, failed to notify the officer that his address had changed. He was arrested on a warrant on June the 5th. He was in court on Tuesday, told Baltimore Circuit Judge Charles Peters, since my mom put me out, I was just coming from the system. He said, so I ain't really have no transportation, no family, no way to call or nothing. Just, you know, I couldn't do it because my mom had kicked me out. He was charged after the riots in Baltimore, pleaded guilty in February of 2016 to charges of rioting and malicious destruction of property. The judge sentenced Bullock to 12 years with all but 6 months suspended. He was placed on 5 years probation after serving the 6 months. He had to agree to complete 400 hours of community service and earn a high school equivalency certificate. And apparently he's been violating his probation ever since. He violated the terms of his probation when he failed to report to his probation officer twice in September of 2016. He then failed to appear in Frederick County Court on August 29th, 2016, and on March 17th, 2017, for 2 pending charges of second-degree assault. When his probation officer attempted to conduct a home visit, officer went to Bullock's mom's home. He wasn't there. Mom told the agent that her son was no longer living there. Prosecutor said Bullock failed to report the address change, also violating the terms of his probation. The public defender for Mr. Bullock, Dana Karangelin, said that her client's been working at a South Baltimore car wash, was planning to enroll in the South Baltimore Learning Center to earn his GED. Bullock himself said, I feel like I should get another chance. I never really wanted to violate. I just didn't have the transportation to get down there to report into my probation officer. Well, the judge asked, why didn't you call? See, you can't get down to the probation office. Why didn't you pick up the phone and call and let people know what was going on? Bullock said, well, I didn't have a phone. Which, in this day and age, if you're working at a car wash, you can't use the car wash's phone? You can't. None of your friends have a phone that you can call? It's impossible for you to access a phone? Okay, maybe that's the case. Maybe it is. Judge said, well, why didn't you walk to the office? You know you got to check in. You don't have access to a phone. You don't have access to a car. Why didn't you walk? He said it was too far. Too far for me to walk. So then the judge sentenced Bullock to 11 and a half years in prison, with all but four suspended. Because, again, there was no attempt for almost a year, it sounds like, to actually abide by the terms of the probation. His mom said she's struggling with the fact that her son's now going to prison. But she said that she is hopeful her son will finish his sentence and return home and lead a normal life. She said he's going to do the right thing this time. I hope so. I do hope so. And one final deal of the day from Richmond, Virginia. Chesterfield, Virginia, one of the Richmond suburbs. There was a shooting June the 6th. 18-year-old Tyquan Whitehead shot and killed. A 16-year-old friend of Whitehead's has been charged with the murder. He says that this was an accidental shooting. But a county prosecutor says, no, this was murder. And they were arguing in court over whether or not Abdul Qadir Craps Robinson should be able to get out of jail on bond, or whether he should be continue to be held without bond. As it turns out, this 16-year-old was already on probation for three assaults in November of last year, including two assaults on police officers when his 18-year-old friend Tyquan Whitehead was shot and killed. A final disposition on those cases, according to the court, had been continued until 2018. The court, by the way, decided to keep this young man behind bars without bond. Noting that he was a flight risk and a threat to the community. The judge questioned whether the suspect's parents could guarantee supervision, asking the mom, for instance, did you know where your son was the day that the shooting occurred? She said, no, I woke up and he was gone. So the judge said he didn't believe that he could trust the 16-year-old, and the potential risk that he posed to the community was too great. But how does somebody who less than a year ago was convicted of three assaults, including two assaults on law enforcement, how's that individual out on the streets, much less in illegal possession of a firearm, 7 months later? How does that happen? Again, they said the final disposition of the case wasn't going to take place until 2018. So I suppose it was stay out of trouble. If you stay out of trouble until 2018, maybe we'll wipe this off your record. Instead of keeping his nose out of trouble, now the 16-year-old's facing first-degree murder charges. And he is our third deal of the day. Now, our good guy today, this is a good story. Also from the Twin Cities area, the St. Paul Pioneer Press, Brad and Molly Nimick, they're from Lindstrom, Minnesota. They were on their way to the Wisconsin Dells to pick up some dogs. Brad and Molly Nimick, one of the things that they do is they rescue dogs that are scheduled to be slaughtered and eaten in Korea Jindus. They were on their way to pick up six dogs. They're driving through downtown Stillwater, Minnesota, and their SUV overheats. And it's done for. The dogs had been flown from Seoul, South Korea to O'Hare. They'd been picked up at O'Hare by a friend of the Nimitz. They were going to meet the Nimitz there at the Wisconsin Dells, about halfway between their home and Chicago. And the Nimitz had to get there. They couldn't reach their friend. They couldn't say, hey, we've been delayed. We're stuck. They didn't know what they were going to do. Molly Nimitz said, we called. We asked him not to tow us. We're trying to get a rental car, but all the rentals were full because it was a holiday weekend, and we needed something large enough to fit six dog kennels. Brad Junker, who is the Stillwater Police Department's community service officer, he went to a check on the Nimitz on June the 30th, about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. He said their hood was up. I asked if there was something I could do, if they needed food or if they needed water. Molly Nimitz just starts crying, said she explained that they might be missing their meeting point. They didn't know what to do. They were trying to make contact with some people back in Lindstrom. They just weren't having any luck. So this is where the story gets really cool. Brad Junker, this police officer in Stillwater, Minnesota. I think we've got a picture of Brad. He tells the Nimitz, and there's Brad with his 2002 Chevy Suburban. That's an important part of the story, because Brad Junker said, why don't you use my car? He said, I've got to work for another 4 or 5 hours. It's just going to be sitting there in the parking lot. Just take my Suburban. He didn't know these people. They'd never met these people before. They didn't live in his hometown. He didn't know them. He said, just use my car. You're good. As you can imagine, Molly Nimitz didn't believe it. But he was serious. She said, he told us, sure, just take my vehicle if that's all you need. He didn't even know us. And that's when he said, I'm going to go and get my Suburban for you to use. He was back within 8 minutes, she said. He just handed us the keys. And he told him, he said, listen, it's almost out of gas. And one of the tires is low. So first thing they did, they go and they fill up the car. They fill up the air. She said, we're driving on I-94. And we just look at each other and we're like, what just happened? She said, my husband said, you know, he must have been an angel in disguise. Well, Brad Junker is, he's not an angel in disguise. He's a police officer there in Stillwater. He said he was moved to learn of the couple's rescue work. He knew that his 18-year-old daughter, Molly, would be moved as well. She is an animal lover. She just talked about the Yulin Dog Meat Festival in China. And he said, I was just delighted that they said that they would use my vehicle. I honestly didn't think it was that big a deal. He said, it just seemed like enough bad things had happened. Let's do something right. So 10 o'clock that night, the Nimitz return with the vehicle. Brad Junker and his daughter got to meet the six dogs. Maple, Monarch, Lilac, Laker, River, and Honeycrisp. Molly Nimitz says all the fosters got to see him and got to sing his praises. He saved the day. And now the dogs are available for adoption. I probably should not mention this website in front of Cameron Gray, or all of a sudden Cameron Gray might have six more dogs at his house. But they are available for adoption through the Rough Start Rescue. And Brad Junker, who's been with the Stillwater PD for 8 years, according to Police Chief Johnny Ganaway, says he's known for paying things forward. He's very good at that. He just does little things throughout the community that he doesn't get recognition for. And the chief wrote up a Facebook post about Brad Junker, shared it on the city's Facebook page. Junker said, I have to admit I'm a bit overwhelmed and sort of embarrassed by the attention when I feel like all I was doing was offering a simple solution to someone who was having a bad day. And he said, and I love this, he said, I'm number six of the seven children raised by Don and Shirley Junker, who showed us time and time again to help out wherever you can, and each of whom would have probably offered the same solution to the Nimitz. I am, he said, my father's son. So Brad Junker, son of Don and Shirley Junker, there in Stillwater, Minnesota. Thank you, sir, for being one of the many, many good guys out there. All right, when we come back on this edition of Cam and Company, Lars Daleside, NRA ILA media liaison, going to join us on the program, Stephen Cruiser of IJ Review later in the hour as well. So stick around. We'll be right back with more Cam and Company right after this.
Speaking with Colton Cassell with NRA Store. Colton, I love talking to you guys at the NRA Store. You have got it going on. You have seemed to be mind readers with us NRA folks to read our minds, what we like, what we need, good, interesting stuff, good quality. So let's get started first, though, Colton. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. What is NRA Store? What is it all about?
NRA Store is a retail storefront for NRA members to shop and buy NRA merchandise while supporting vital NRA programs.
And let's expand on that a little bit. Where does the money from NRA Store go?
100% of the profits go directly to support vital NRA programs. So when you're shopping with us, you're supporting ILA and all other important initiatives that the NRA are standing behind.
Which, Colton, I think is so cool because we like to donate to the NRA because we believe in the NRA and supporting the Second Amendment. But at the same time, you buy something, you get this really good, practical stuff, and guess what? You're helping to support the NRA. So that's awesome. A lot of great items that we can get into. But let's also talk about other stuff you guys do. You have giveaways at NRAstore.com. You have clearance department, virtual online catalogs. I know I've gotten regular catalogs from you guys. You got a lot of stuff going on there on that website, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, we have a NRA Store customer club, so you can actually go right onto our main page, our main NRA Store page, and join the customer club just by simply entering an email. That signs you up for monthly promotions where we do shipping discounts, special sales.
Man, I need to get on that.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. It's the place to be.
We're almost out of time. Colton Cassell with NRA Store. All that information, sir, is at NRAstore.com, correct?
Yes, sir.
NRAstore.com, Colton Cassell with NRA Store. Thank you for what you do, and thanks for being on the program.
Last summer, 5 Dallas law enforcement officers were killed while protecting hundreds of protesters who marched against America's police. My brother, Mike Kroll, was one of them. No protesters lost their lives. No media were hit by bullets. But Mike was there, protecting, serving, sacrificing, as he did every day for 8 years on the Dallas PD. The National Rifle Association honors such sacrifice. While the media paints our police as criminals and celebrities attack them, the NRA backs our blue. Now you can too. Donate your vehicles to NRA Cars for Freedom. Visit NRACarsForFreedom.com or call 1-866-NRA-GIFT. Donations are tax deductible and will help provide training for law enforcement. My brother gave his life protecting those who marched against him. That's why I back our blue. Stand with me. NRACarsForFreedom.com. 1-866-NRA-GIFT.
It's as patriotic as it gets. A gathering in the heartland of folks from all 50 states. Welders, salesmen, farmers, accountants, soldiers, first responders. Here, we're all the same. Here, we are all race fans. We are proud of our country, proud of our military, proud of our drivers. We proudly stand for our national anthem. And we have a great reverence for names like Yarborough, Earnhardt, Waltrip, and Gordon. Yes, there are other NASCAR races, but this one is special. 500 temper flaring, finger waving, ego busting 15 second laps. And deep into the warm August night, hardly a seat in the last great Coliseum will be used. You see, this isn't just a race. This is America's night race. The Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. And another reminder, if you would like to attend the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race at the Bristol Motor Speedway, when you do so, you can get your tickets at NRARaceTix.com. Use the promo code B17NRA, all caps, B17NRA. And I'm telling you, it is going to be an incredible weekend. If you can get there for all of race week, do it. You'll enjoy it. But if you can't get there for the entirety of race week, make sure you're there Saturday night for the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race because it is going to be spectacular. Right now, I want to welcome to the program NRA ILA Media Liaison Lars Dealside is with us. Lars, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Cam. How about yourself?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program. And I saw today that Every Town for Gun Safety claiming it has been a great year for gun control at the state level, Lars.
Yeah, and it's always encouraging to see that whenever every town puts out a statement, it's all taken as fact and truth. But whenever we put out a statement, it's always they try to gnaw down to the very bits and pieces of it and try to check every little thing. But they don't bother checking what they have to say. Of course, that has to be the truth. And unfortunately, it really wasn't.
Okay, so let's burrow down a little bit. Because, you know, one of the things that I noticed, and I just sort of glanced over, I didn't spend a whole lot of time reading the Everytown press release, but and it may have been a news article, but I guess it's close to the same thing, as you say, when the media dealing with Everytown. But I did notice that there was no mention of New Mexico this year, which I thought was kind of interesting because, you know, that's a case where Michael Bloomberg thought that he had the numbers in the New Mexico legislature to pass a, quote-unquote, universal background check bill, and said that bill couldn't even make it out of committee, Lars.
Yeah, it's you know, they go through these things and they think that they know what they're doing, and that's one of the most dangerous parts when it comes to stuff like this, that you really should have a bit of a specialization or a background and understand how legislation works and how the laws are constructed in order to make sure that what they're trying to do is actually going to work if and when it passes, because most of the time it isn't even going to pass. And in New Mexico, you know, we were successful in defeating the Bloomberg effort to criminalize firearm transfers, and it's just the way that they do it and the way that they act and then the way that they claim victory when there is none is just disheartening, especially when you see the media come through and accept it as fact. Because, you know, I was going through our stuff, and I have, or what I have is as of June 30th, and we saw 60 pro-gun bills, state bills, signed into law, two that are still awaiting signature, and 38 pieces that are pending. And when you look at their side, they had three anti-gun bills signed into law, with 92 failing to pass and 56 standing. So if they're going to sit there and claim victory, you know, that's not the kind of victory that I would want.
No. But, okay, so Everytown says, yeah, but Lars, some of those that you're talking about like NRA license plates and stuff like that as pro-gun bills. Now, they're not talking about things like campus carry, right, which was passed by Georgia this year and went into effect on July the 1st. What are some of the other big bills, the other big pro-gun bills that have passed this year?
Yeah, well, we had firearm permit fees were bills passed in Texas and Connecticut. We had constitutional carry passing in New Hampshire and North Dakota. The campus carry, what you said, in Georgia. We eliminated gun-free zones in Arkansas, Tennessee, and West Virginia, and got some concealed carry reciprocity movement in Georgia and Kansas. I mean, these are not minor things. These are big victories. Like I said, it was 60 overall. Are there license plate laws in there that are passed as well? Sure. But those things, every little bit actually helps us out, even from mm-hmm. the small to the big ones, like lessening the gun-free zones, like I said, as we saw in Arkansas, Tennessee, and West Virginia. You know, if you're going to sit there and make statements about how you're being very effective and then show for the fact that I'm only going to show one or two things in which we won and say that that's a victory, you know, that's... You know, it's a heck of a way to keep track. It's a heck of a way for a report card. I know if that I brought that home back when I was a kid, I would have got a smack to the head. So
right. Look at avoid the F in science. Look, I got an S in penmanship. You know, that's satisfactory, Dad.
There's 20 other letters behind it in the alphabet. So
I mean, I get what you're saying, and I think that you're right about that because. You know, look, I mean, I'm sure that every town would say, Cam, you're not objective at all. But I try to look at this objectively. And, you know, they have seen, like, California. California, Lars, is probably going to pass their one gun a month bill, right? And I did note that they had placed their open carry ban on unincorporated areas of California counties on the suspense file. So that's still alive. But they'll probably get some pro-gun control bills passed and onto Governor Brown's desk in California. But that's really like the place where they're likely to see the most success. Meanwhile, you know, I'm sorry, campus carry in Georgia is a big deal. I think the Arkansas concealed carry revisions are a big deal, along with West Virginia and Tennessee. I think the two additional states that have become constitutional carry, also very big deals because we now have more states around the country that are constitutional carry than like the restrictive may issue laws like Maryland or New Jersey or even California. That's huge.
Yeah, and it's again, like you were saying, it's an interesting way for them to keep score, and especially when it comes to something like the constitutional carry. And it's the thing that we see all the time when we're trying to work with these bills in the different states. They come out with these predictions of doom and gloom. It's going to turn into the wild, wild west, and it never does. So then we go into next year's legislative session, and we try to introduce it into South Dakota or another state, and they're going to come out there and say, it's going to turn into, you mean like you said, last year or 5 years ago or 10 years ago, and it didn't happen. But still, they put it up there. The reporters are happy to say that and repeat it because it's a sexy headline and it's going to count for page views. So instead of actually worrying about the facts, it's actually a discussion I had a friend with mine the other day. Problem is that we deal with facts and figures, and they deal on the emotional side. And the emotional side is a much easier story to write than the facts and figures. And that's why we usually get what we get, like we did today with this political article you were talking about.
Yeah. Well, and listen, you know, don't get me wrong. The gun control movement, you know, they are active. And, you know, Bloomberg is spending a lot of time and resources making sure that they have a presence in as many state capitals as possible. I don't want people to get the idea that the gun control movement doesn't pose a threat, because clearly, you know, they're working hard to try to not just pass legislation, but to, I think, get that narrative going. And we're seeing this with the reporting today, get that narrative of success going. So the media will ignore the defeats for the anti-gun groups, and they'll puff up these successes or the successful legislation that they passed, with that intent of telling Americans who are, you know, casual observers of this issue, oh, look who has momentum. Don't you want to be a part of this group? And oh, aren't they doing so many big things, while ignoring not just, again, the failure of legislation to get passed in New Mexico, but the referendum that went into effect in Nevada, Lars, that they wrote that can't be enforced because the FBI won't do the background checks that every town demanded that they do. The magazine ban, which went into effect in California July the 1st, but a federal judge has issued a temporary injunction saying that the state of California not likely to win in its defense of this magazine ban. I mean, the successful laws, the laws that the gun control groups have had success in actually passing, they're also having some challenges keeping those laws on the books, right?
Yeah, it's as I was saying earlier, you have to actually understand how the law works. You have to understand how the system works. And, you know, if I'm going to sit there and claim success for passing some law that can't be enforced, it's not a success at all. I mean, the fact is, you have these people out there, they're talking about, oh, this is great for gun safety. And you know what's great for gun safety? The NRA. The NRA has over 120,000 instructors that are teaching more than a million people every year how to safely and responsibly use a firearm. That's gun safety. The ability for you to carry a firearm as you're out and about with your family, that's gun safety. The fact that you're allowed to protect your home when a bad guy breaks in, that's gun safety. Not trying to restrict your rights to be able to do that.
Absolutely. Lars, listen, I do appreciate you joining us on the program. Most of the state legislatures around the country have adjourned for the year, but there are still a few that are in recess, and they'll be back. So I know we'll be talking again about legislation. We've got some pro-gun bills in Ohio that are still on the move, and a lot of other states around the country. So I know we'll be talking again very soon.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, Cam.
All right. Have a good day. Lars Dielside joins NRA ILA Media Liaison. Make sure you're following NRA's Institute for Legislative Action on Twitter at NRA ILA. And hopefully NRAILA.org is one of your daily stops, along with NRATV.com. But make sure that you subscribe to the Grassroots Alert from NRA's Institute for Legislative Action as well. That way you can get some localized, personalized news and information about what's going on with the Second Amendment where you live, so that you can get involved, because that really is where we make a difference. You know, there are millions of NRA members all around the country who are engaged. We're active. We're involved. And this is, you know, look, it's an off year. Most states don't have elections taking place this year. You might have some local elections coming up in November. Here in Virginia, oh, we've got our elections. New Jersey has elections this year. But no matter where you live, there is still something for you to do right now to protect and defend our right to keep and bear arms. So Stephen Cruiser of IJ Review going to join us here in just a minute or two. We might have to talk with Stephen about Shia LaBeouf, who has issued what... Now, I don't know how sincere this is, but I will say this. This would appear to be one of the more... sincere is not the word. This would appear to be one of those apologies that actually accepts personal responsibility, unlike the, I'm sorry if you got offended. I'm sorry if you didn't like what I said. I'm sorry if you didn't like what I did. You may have heard Shia LaBeouf got arrested over the weekend, public drunk in Savannah, Georgia. Apparently accosted an individual who he had asked for a cigarette and then began accosting the individual who did not give him a cigarette. Ended up getting arrested. The police statement said he became disorderly, using profanities and vulgar language in front of the women and children present. He was told to leave the area and refused, becoming aggressive towards the officer. When the officer attempted to place LaBeouf under arrest, he ran to a nearby hotel. He was arrested in the hotel lobby, where his disorderly behavior continued. As Rolling Stone reports in a video obtained by TMZ, an irate LaBeouf tells one of the arresting officers, who is black, "You've got a president that don't give a bleep about you. You're stuck in a police force that doesn't give a bleep about you. You want to arrest white people who give a bleep, who ask for cigarettes. I've got more millionaire lawyers than you know what to do with, you stupid bleep." That was just a small portion of Shia LaBeouf's comments to the law enforcement officers arresting him. And last night, he released a screen grab on Twitter. "I'm deeply ashamed of my behavior, and I make no excuses for it. I don't know if these statements are too frequent or not shared often enough, but I'm certain that my actions warrant a very sincere apology to the arresting officers, and I'm grateful for their restraint. The severity of my behavior is not lost on me. My outright disrespect for authority is problematic, to say the least, and completely destructive, to say the worst. It is a new low. A new low, I hope, is a bottom. I've been struggling with addiction publicly for far too long, and I'm actively taking steps towards securing my sobriety, and I hope that I can be forgiven for my mistakes." You know, again, Cameron, I'm curious, before we take a break, your thoughts on that. We see celebrity asshat behavior on a regular basis.
Right.
Like I said, I don't know if that apology is sincere. Next week, Shia LaBeouf could be back to being an asshat. But the language that he used was a little more direct than what we typically see from I'm sorry I did that apology.
No, you're totally right, as opposed to... a Kathy Griffin type apology where, you know, like you said, I'm sorry if you're offended. But the thing that gets me with apologies like this, and you go back to Bill Maher apologizing, they use horrific racial slurs that are just inexcusable. And for some reason, I think Bill Maher gets a little less slack for this because of his seeming anti-Muslim statements that people on the left are already mad at him for. So I think it might be different for him. But if you're on the left and you say something horrific, just horrific, I mean, something that should never pass your lips, drunk or not, I'm sorry, it gets you right off the hook. Let's say someone, you know, on this side, you know, we were playing the Bristol ads, like a Charlie Daniels, or, you know, we're so bereft of conservative, John Voight. I mean, I'm trying to pick off the seven that we got. You know, they said something like that. Never, ever, 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 ever forgiven. But this is like, you know, it's fine. And it's maddening, because there's no excuse, drunk, high, stoned, whatever. You just don't use language like that.
I would agree with you. And I don't know if it's if the attitude is, fine, whatever. I don't know that. I don't know. We'll see, I guess. I mean, I don't know if. See, part of the problem is I don't know if Shia LaBeouf has been like a bankable box office right. star.
Well, there's that.
You know what I mean? Like,
but also,
he's kind of been one of those celebrities that's just feeding off of his celebrity. And I don't know that this is going to help him get any jobs or anything.
Right. And the reason he's been in the news lately is because his complete. Coming off the rails, you're screaming at a "we will not be divided" or some nonsense, just screaming at the top of his voice in some webcam, and then like hiding in Finland, and 4chan had to track him down by the coordinates of the flag on the building. I mean, it's just lunatic. It's lunatic stories. But he just does these crazy things, and then people go to this museum and they like have to like there's only a one way feed, and they don't know where he is. It's just. Everything about him recently has been crazy. So I find it harder to forgive him, because he's just a nut job.
As he says, he's been struggling with addiction publicly for far too long and actively taking steps towards securing his sobriety. So who knows? Maybe a much more normal Shia LaBeouf will show up one day. In the meantime, I'm thinking about hiding out somewhere and just using a flag, and people can try to find me based on the flag. Maybe just like a slab of bacon, and just we'll just post the bacon. Where's Cam? All right, we're going to take a timeout. When we come back, Stephen Cruiser of IJ Review, he will not divide us, but he will join us right after a quick break. So stick around. Much more Cam and Company coming up right after this. Here with our friend Ron Bellin from Reaper Outdoors. We've seen anti-hunting activists go out and attack everything from prairie dog hunts, hunting in Africa. Yeah. You know, you hunt hogs with knives and dogs. I can only imagine what PETA and HSUS would say if they heard about how you hunt.
Oh, they like us. They love us because then they have a job, because then they have something to complain about, which is the most primitive hunting in the world. Anti-hunters will complain about us using AR platforms because it's unfair. And then when you go chasing them like they did before guns were even invented and use knives, they'll complain about that. So they're just going to complain. They're just always going to be that type of person. And that's what's so cool about being here and being surrounded by like-minded people like you and myself. And, you know, if it's not for hunters, hunters are the largest conservation force out there today. They really are. If you want to talk environmentalists and take care of the environment, that's what hunters do. They pick up the trash. They thin the herd, if you will. They eat the meat that they kill. And the most organic meat on the planet is wild animals. So the complaints that we get, we are fighting it. We fight it up in Maine every year with the anti-baiting, anti-dog for bear hunting because they don't understand hunting, period. And also even dogs used for deer in the south. Southeast, it is a little different, but these clubs do a really good job. These are dogs that are trained to do what they do. The hog dogs take care of themselves, take care of the trainers, take care of them and the owners like you wouldn't believe. They care more for them than they do their families. I'm telling you, they get treated really well.
You know, and it's funny, you talk about how it doesn't matter what the tool is, right? The anti-hunters, they don't like hunting. That's what they're opposed to. It's not that they're opposed to hunting with an AR or hunting with a shotgun or hunting with a knife. They're opposed to you hunting. And yet, I mean, this is in your blood, Ron. You grew up hunting in Pennsylvania. You hunted to eat growing up. I mean, this is a part of who you are.
That's how we survived. We literally grew up with nothing. When I was born, my father looked at a map and he found out where the least amount of population was in Pennsylvania. And him and my mother bought 4 acres, borrowed the money from my grandparents, bought 4 acres, built a little log cabin, no running water, no electricity, and we had to pump water. Eventually, we did get a well to pump out because we had no electricity for a pump. And we used to get water from the stream. We lived in Alaska, dirt floor, one-room log cabin, and we gold mined up there, and no electricity, no running water, outhouse, and we lived off the land. And that's the thing, you bring up a great point with the anti-hunters will go to a store and they'll buy prepackaged meat, no matter what it is. And they'll bring it home and feed their kids the steroid injected whatever. I eat meat from the fridge as well. But a hunter will go out and eat the most organic. I keep going back to that. The most primordial thing is to go eat your own food. And there's nothing better or more satisfying than actually going out and getting your own food, packaging it, storing it, and feeding your friends and family.
Absolutely. Even in this day and age where, again, it's easy to go down to the grocery store and, you know, pick up a package of chicken or a package of beef or whatever. But to know that if you needed to, that you didn't need the grocery store, to prove to yourself that, yes, I can go out and I can do this. I mean, that feeling that you get inside, it's tapping into something that's primal. It's tapping into something that, you know, goes back as long as mankind has been around. We've been hunting. And so to be able to tap into that experience, I think is amazing.
It is. And it's satisfaction. Every time I make a meal at my house, it's satisfaction. I have 3 freezers because we do a lot of hunting, obviously. But we, you know, my friends come over and we have converted people that didn't even eat meat because they didn't want to eat steroid injected or whatever, and antibiotic injected animals. But then they come over and they eat wild bear Like, wow. They'll eat wild boar. They'll eat. So now they're eating wild animal meat. The other thing we didn't touch on, but is there's a season for these animals. So it's not like hunters are going out and just killing animals at their leisure.
Right.
There's actual seasons and there's limits. And what that does is adjust these herds, because as humans are spreading out through this world and where our population is growing, we're impacting the environment that these animals live in. So we do have to control the population in a sense through hunters is a great way to do it.
All right, man. Listen, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you. And hey, Cam, like always, man, thank you for what you do for us.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. You can find our next guest on Twitter at Stephen Cruiser. That's Stephen with a PH, Cruiser with a K. You can also read him at IJReview.com. Stephen, how are you, sir?
I'm fantastic. How are you?
I'm excellent. So in the, we now live in a world in which every day is a made-up holiday, right?
Yes.
Every day is something day.
National something day, yes.
And so I think it was 2 days ago, it was Cow Appreciation Day. I don't know how you celebrated, hopefully with a nice T-bone.
I did not know. I was on a plane most of that day, so I didn't. I was celebrating it with a nice vodka.
Well, okay. Vodka can be made from grain, which cows eat. So I suppose, yeah. You know, in a way. Okay, there you go. I did see a story about vegan protesters showing up at a Chick-fil-A in Florida with bloody shirts and fake knives. Now, why would you protest a Chick-fil-A on Cow Appreciation Day? Why would you do that?
Yeah, they were a little backwards on that. And I don't understand. This is, you know, they're the militant vegans. I don't get them at all. It's like, just, I don't care what you do. If you want to do that, do that.
Right?
But don't bug me about it. Don't make this a cause. I get that you don't like eating animals and everything, but most of the world is still eating animals, so you're not going to change that. I mean, pick a more realistic goal in life.
But this is, I mean, look, this is what people do now. Right? You don't like something. You can't just let it go. You can't let other people live their life. You have to go try and shame them. You have to issue demands now. It's not even like, hey, I'd like to ask you to stop doing this. It's, I demand you do X. And sort of left implied is, you know, or else something is going to happen.
And I've spent most of my life living in horror of everybody adopting my habits. I don't want anybody to be like me. So I'm quite the opposite. I'm never encouraging anyone to be like me.
I mean, I'm a proud omnivore. I love eating meat and I love bacon and just give me a nice juicy rare steak. But I cannot for the life of me envision myself going down to some vegetarian restaurant with like a placard or a sign and just, you know, right meat. I like you, you know, do what you want. You don't want to eat meat? Don't eat meat. Don't want to own a gun? Don't own a gun. I mean, it's real simple.
Yeah. And this is one of the few things that I will actually blame social media for making worse is because now you have a wider audience for your opinions all the time. So everybody's more, you know, apt to, well, you believe this, I don't believe you should, you know, everybody's more, they get a little preachy all the time. So I don't like to blame social media for everything, but I think it probably has made this misbegotten crusaderism worse.
I think you're probably right. There was it's a book, but it's a very short book. It's only like 112 pages. And it's called Kill All Normies, and it came out, I think, like last month. And it's written by someone from the left, and it's taking a look at the rise of the alt-right online. But she also spends like a chapter talking about the rise of the snowflake culture on the left. And she sort of blames the rise of the alt-right on like 4chan and Reddit, and she blames the rise of the snowflake left on Tumblr. And it's kind of an interesting theory. I don't know how much veracity there is to it, but the idea that, you know, on social media, you are typically engaging with people that you agree with, but in order to get them engaged, you sort of have to ramp up the emotion, right? And protesting is the anger is the easiest emotion to try to, you know, get people swayed by. And so I think we are seeing more and more of that amplified by social media as a way of getting attention, not just for the message, but for the individual, too.
But then it never dies down afterwards. It just keeps, it turns into a feeding frenzy. And there's power in community, even when the community is full of idiots. And that's the problem. It's not really a problem. I think, you know, we go through these evolutions in the way we communicate and everything, and you got to figure out a way to adjust sooner or later. And social media, you know, in the grand scheme of things, is still relatively new. You know, I've been on Twitter, I think, 7 years. It's not a long time. It feels like I've been on Twitter forever because it wears me down sometimes. But so I think that sooner or later, Twitter's a lot different than it was when I first started hanging out on it, too. So, you know, I'm sure it'll evolve. We'll figure it out. Soon we'll all have chips in our heads and be communicating telepathically anyway, and it won't be as loud. So we'll have that going for us.
Well, in the meantime, until we communicate telepathically, we are still relying on things like social media, broadcast, satellite radio, terrestrial radio. So let's talk about Radio SFK for a minute or two.
Yes, thank you. Tomorrow night on KABC Radio, part of the Cumulus system here, I've been doing a lot of in-studio stuff for them with my good friends John Phillips and Jillian Barbary for a long time now. They're giving me my own special tomorrow. I don't know if there's going to be a medical attendant to make sure everything's okay, but they're giving me a two-hour special tomorrow night, and we're just trying to figure out, you know, where I fit in there. So we're going to have some fun. I'm going to have a couple of comedian friends on. We're going to be talking. Conservatives are always talking about, you know, mixing in the culture finally with politics and everything. And then somehow you do a great job of that. Not a lot of people do. I've been living it for 30 years, so I want to do it on the radio more. So we're going to talk entertainment. There will be a little bit of politics. I've got an author of this book about how people can change their habits and their lives. And I'm going to ask him how everybody can stop being so insane politically using his methods. So it's going to be fun. It's going to be 2 hours free for all. You can listen to it. Anybody in the country, you can listen to it at KABC.com, or KABC also is on the iHeartRadio network.
Okay.
And it'll be 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. Eastern time tomorrow.
11 p.m., 1 a.m. Eastern. If you're on the West Coast, 8 to 10 p.m. I will be in my car probably getting down to Bristol, Virginia, right around the time that you are signing on. So I will listen in my motel room.
Thank you very much.
That's an exciting Friday night. Let me tell you what, Stephen Cruz on the radio while you're listening from a motel room in Bristol, Virginia. Doesn't get any better than that.
I think that's the very definition of living the dream right there.
Now, this is exciting stuff. I mean, this is good. And frankly, we need more voices like yours on KBC. I wish that there was a way that we could, I don't know, have trucks with giant loudspeakers just park in front of some celebrity homes and just, you know, blare out your special on the streets of Beverly Hills tomorrow night.
Well, you know, knock on wood, if it goes well, then there will be more opportunities there for me to share my opinions. And that'll be the only time then. I won't be out on the street bugging people to be like me. But if I'm on the radio, I might exhort them to be a little bit like me.
Well, I mean, KBC, this is a conservative station. Is it fair to call it that?
Mostly, yeah. I mean, the drive show I do, John Phillips, you know, he's an old PJTV colleague of mine. He's a CNN contributor. He's very conservative. Some of the people are more middle-ish, but it's most everybody is at least in the center right or right there.
Okay. All right. Well, again, we'll be able to tune in. KABC.com, 8 to 10 Pacific, 11 to 1. That's tomorrow night. You can hear the Stephen Cruiser radio special. Do you have like cool intro music and everything already picked out?
I'm going to talk to them about that today because this is the producer I work with John and Jillian all the time. So he and I know each other well, and he's got a good feel for me. And we're going to nail down that stuff. And then I hit the road next week, but I should be able to be with you on Wednesday. I'm headlining Crackers in Indianapolis next week.
Oh, are you banning Tony Katz from attending your show?
No, Katz is going to be down there with a whole group of people on Saturday night.
You're actually letting him in the building. You're not afraid of him heckling you.
No, but it'll be fun. I've been laying off clubs for several years while my daughter finished high school and got settled in college, and now it's time. It's time for me to go share that with America again, too.
Now, this is exciting stuff. I now that I know that you're back out on the road, I want to bring you to Richmond, Virginia. I know we've got a comedy club, I think, in Midlothian, Virginia. What does it take to get you to a comedy club?
Let's find out who books it. I mean, usually once they find out, you know, I've already got an audience, they're more than happy to have me in.
All right. Funny Bone Comedy Club and Restaurant in Richmond. That's my goal, to bring you there.
fantastic. Let's get on that.
We'll do it. Steven, listen, as always, sir, I appreciate you coming on the program. Enjoy the radio show tomorrow night. I do hope I get a chance to tune in.
Okay, thank you very much. Have a good weekend.
All right, you too, sir. Steven Kruiser, join us again on Twitter, at Steven Kruiser, IJReview.com, and tomorrow night, Friday night, 8 to 10 Pacific on KABC in Los Angeles, and then next week at Crackers in Indianapolis. I think it's a care. I think he's making a mistake letting Tony Katz in. I mean.
Oh, my God, yes. It just reminds me of, growing up on the Stern Show, here on Sirius XM, and just when all the comedians would come on, there was always like Zanies in Dayton, and hearing a guest talking about Crackers in Indianapolis. It just brings back the good old days of comedy clubs.
Right, yeah. I'll be at McGiggles in Des Moines coming up Friday night. Come see me. Yeah, well, we got the Funny Bone Comedy Club and Restaurant in Richmond, Virginia. We need the Comedy Hut in Farmville. That's what we're not kind of big enough for like a whole store or anything. It would just have to be. We did have a Pizza Hut closed down. Now that I'm thinking about it, so that'd be pretty easy to just turn into the Comedy Hut in Farmville. I might have to do some digging on that. All right, we are unfortunately almost out of time, but tomorrow we're going to be talking with our friend Ed Morrissey from Hot Air. Also, Tony Katz from WIBC in Indianapolis. We'll find out what heckling Tony has on tap for next week at Crackers Comedy Club in Indianapolis, Indiana. Brian Lilly from Beyond the News will join us as well, and we'll be touching in with the latest doings in Fairfax, Virginia, and the protest against the National Rifle Association on what could be one of the hottest days of the year, temperature-wise. I'm guessing that maybe the rhetoric will be a little hot outside of the NRA tomorrow as well. But in the meantime, thank you so much for being a part of today's program. And we'll do it again tomorrow, live, 2 p.m. Eastern, right here on NRA TV, midnight Eastern, Sirius XM Patriot 125. And don't forget, we're available on demand all the time through the NRA TV website, through the app, also through iHeartRadio and iTunes as well. Be safe, have fun with the rest of your Thursday. We'll talk to you soon with more Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady.